Okay, let's get the show going.
But we'll see, you guys got a vote, so.
Good afternoon, I'm Jim Owens, the task force facilitator. And a couple quick logistic things. The restrooms. So the men's are on the left, the women's are on the right. We have a public comment sign-up sheet over here, and we will have a couple public comment periods for those who are interested in commenting today. So why don't we start with a round of introductions, and Jim, if we could start with you.
Hi, I'm Jim Martin. I formerly worked for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Now I'm conservation director for the largest fishing tackle company in the world, and I'm here representing the state fishing industry.
Hi, Scott Welch, Global Corporate Relations Manager, Columbia Sportswear Company.
I'm Claire Pucci. I'm retired, but I had a part of my career at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, where I headed up the Wildlife Diversity Program. Also worked for the City of Portland in their Terrestrial Ecology Program, and an assorted bunch of other jobs.
Meryl Reddish, former Executive Director for the Audubon Society of Portland.
Rob Ball, retired lawyer, member of the board of the Nature Conservancy.
Wayne Krieger, I've retired three times. I'm state rep in District 1, South Coast now.
Brad Pettinger, Brookings, Oregon, representing the commercial fisheries.
Kenji Sugihara, I'm also one of those pesky lawyers. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Bicycle Racing Association and also Oregon Tourism Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Mark Labhart. I have the privilege of being the chair of Tillamook County Board of Commissioners.
Paul Don Heffner, I'm the Midwest Director on the board of the Oregon Hunters Association, and before that I retired from the Marine Board after being its director for 25 years.
Keta Gonzalez, Center for Diversity and the Environment, Interim Director.
My name is Michael Finley. I'm chair of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission, and formerly I had a 32-year career with the National Park Service, Superintendent of Yellowstone, Yosemite, Everglades, and 10 years as a law enforcement ranger.
I'm Rob Morrison, the Vice President of Global Marketing for Leupold and Stevens.
Kurt Melcher, Director, Department of Fish and Wildlife.
I'm Carrie Westland with Travel Lane County, based in Eugene.
Go ahead and introduce yourself, too.
Hi, I'm Dave Chadwick from the Montana Wildlife Federation. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay. And Brett Brown's come with Governor Brown's office. And thank you, Dave, for being here.
Roger Furman, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Okay. And Mike?
Hi, I'm Mike Herbel. I'm a businessman from the coast of Oregon, and I spent 25 years in the cable television industry and very involved in fishing and hunting.
And our support staff?
Alicia Martin with Tobin Owen Train.
So that's the glue that holds things together. So we have a new face among us, Scott, welcome.
Yeah, and I wanted to just, for all of you on the task force here, so Scott is stepping in for Peter Bragdon, and Scott has introduced himself already, but Peter flagged for me and the governor some time conflicts that he's got, and he's going to remain engaged in the task force. Wanted you all to know that. And Scott, he may have passed along other messages through you, but wanted to be sure that Columbia had good, strong, present representation here at the table. So the governor has made the change, and Scott, we're really, really glad to have you here on the task force. It's a little bit of a strange setting here, but as Representative Krieger well knows, session is going on, so it all kind of feels like a hearing room here. But totally. This is probably the friendliest setting in the building.
I doubt it.
True. So the first thing we want to deal with today is talk about the role and election of a chair. And in the late 1700s, many houses consisted of a large room with only one chair, commonly a long board folded down from the wall and was used for dining. The head of the household always sat in the chair while everyone else ate, sitting on the floor. Occasionally a guest, usually a man, would be invited to sit in this chair during the meal. To sit in the chair meant that you were important and in charge. They called the one sitting at the chairman. So that's how the term chairman was derived.
That's not a joke.
No, that's not a joke. That's
just checking. I don't often know with you.
Yeah, that's the point. You're not always going to know. We have a facilitator and a chair, and just real briefly, the different roles are. As facilitator, my job is to help run the process, make sure that we move forward and that we get you to the end point, and that you have all the information you need and that we respond to your questions, et cetera. Your chairperson is the one who runs meetings and is a sounding board for issues and concerns you have, liaison during meetings, a role that I also play, and your face with the media, media requests and all that. We indicated in the charter we discussed at the last meeting that the chairperson would be the voice for this group. We have a different type of process here. We have a legislative task force in which we do not have a legislator sitting in the chair position. And we've heard a concern that there was some manipulation of a candidate for chair today. And I want to start by saying it would be incorrect to blame Brett, because it was my idea to try to secure somebody as early as possible to chair this process. I did that at the beginning of our last meeting. I approached an individual here, asked if they were interested and available. When I heard that that was a positive, then I spoke to our legislative members, and then I've spoken with all of you. And that was a staff recommendation of a candidate. It's up to you who you select. And I'm going to stop there and ask if there's any comments and if anybody wishes to make a nomination. We want to nominate? Comments? It's your chair. You have to nominate somebody and take action. Jim.
Well, I thought it was kind of unusual for Jim to call me up and say, Mark Labhart has agreed to be chair. Do you have any problem with that? So my answer to him is, no, I didn't have any problem with that. We subsequently had a little conversation about that particular approach, which was unusual for most of the committees that I've ever served in. But having said that, I've worked with Mark for many, many years, back when he was with the Department of Forestry, and have extreme respect for him in the role he plays now as a county commissioner. I've been through a jillion meetings where he was the leader, and I'd like to nominate Mark Labhart.
Second.
Everybody wants to speak up now, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, exactly.
Anybody want to fight over that? Comments?
I'll take it.
Okay. All those in favor of Mark serving as chair of this group, if you could turn your name tents up, please.
I still agree.
It's almost unanimous.
Thank you.
Could you say aye?
Could you grab me that
point of clarification that. ex officio? Okay, I just want to make sure you didn't
sure,
think I would.
Sure,
Kurt. I can't vote either. Okay.
You can vote, they just can't count your vote.
Okay.
Mark,
thank
I
you.
Voted for you anyway.
Okay.
Mark?
Thank
turn
you.
Turn it over to you.
I'm going to talk a little bit later, but just I'm going to just for a second, just give you a little bit of background why I, when Jim did call me and actually volunteered, you know, said, would you be willing to do this? Just so you know, I have a real affinity for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. When the STEP Advisory Committee first got formed, I served on that for quite a few years. I served a couple terms as chair of the STEP Advisory Committee. Then the R&E board got going, the Fish Restoration Enhancement Board. I served, I think, three terms on the R&E board. I served a couple terms as chair of the R&E board. When the Hatchery Research Center fired up, that's where I got to know a lot of the folks here, but I was on the first Fish Restoration Enhancement Board, served there. I wasn't chair of that board. When the Coastal Salmon Plan was put together, I served on that task force with Jim on Coastal Salmon, and then I've served on ODF&W's Budget Committee as one of the folks representing county. So when he called me and said, you know, would you be interested? I'm going to try to get this thing going. I don't want to have a false start on doing this. I said, well, you know, I would be very interested in doing that if you all supported that. I care a lot about ODF&W. I care about where we're going. So I will try to do my best to represent you all in this process. So, and I'll have a few other words a little bit later on. So thank you very much and for your support. I'll need that as we move along. So thank you. Okay, Jim, I'm going to turn it back over to you. We've got some housekeeping things to talk about. So,
yeah, before we get in the program, we want to take care of a few housekeeping things. So we threw a lot of materials at you between the first meeting and this meeting, and there were four major distributions. One was a bibliography of a variety of background documents, and hopefully you were able to access those documents. We gave you both a bibliography and a link to a base camp site where all the documents were posted. And we'll continue to do that so that you don't get these huge files overloading your computer. We also distributed a response to the information requests that came from the last meeting and from my initial interviews with you. So we had put together a list of all the things you requested, turn it over to the department. I thought they did a great job in responding to the information you requested. Recently, we sent out a straw man problem statement and some considerations for developing guidelines and criteria. That's going to be the focus of the second half of the meeting today. So hopefully you had an opportunity to look at that document. And then lastly, we sent out some documents that provided some background on criteria used elsewhere that we think will be helpful for today's discussion. And then there's a plethora of other minor documents we sent you. And apologies if we've overloaded you here at the front end, but we wanted all of us to get a good grounding in what's going on elsewhere and work that's been previously done. So meeting schedule. So we have distributed to you a proposed schedule. We have a meeting date secured for March and April. And then we threw out some other dates that we hope are going to work for you all. We did hear a desire to, as soon as possible, get dates nailed. So that's what's in front of you. And any comments or concerns about that schedule at this point? We're good to go with it? Great.
Can we firm up the out dates? Can we firm up the out dates?
I think that's what he's proposing is, dates would be... If it's okay with the rest of you, those would be the dates for all the way out through August.
Okay, good.
So, and I'll send around a calendar invite with those future dates, too, so that you not only have that email message, but you actually have calendar invites for those dates.
Jim, can you just refresh our memory with what those dates are for those of us who...
Afraid you were going to ask that.
Perhaps didn't bring along our...
Grab that piece of paper.
I have it.
I remember March 30th for sure was the next one.
Yep. April 26th. June 8th, June 30th, and August 15th.
Thanks, Kenji.
Yeah, no worries.
What's the April date, Kenji?
April 26th.
26th, okay. Thank you very much.
Jim, should we just let you know if we can't make one of them?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, let me know. And we do not have locations secured for those meeting dates. Those tend to evolve depending on what's going on here in this building, so... as soon as we do, we'll let you know what those locations are. And then we got a couple questions about responding to outside inquiries, people asking about How do I find out the agendas are? How do I know what materials you're receiving, et cetera? All of those materials are on the task force site now. And as soon as we send you something, it gets posted. So if you get inquiries, please direct them to that site. Again, we're not maintaining an interested parties list. Instead, you need to subscribe to the e-subscribe service for legislative committees. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay. Mark, that's all I had at this point.
Okay, thanks. So I'd like to do a couple things. First, just give you, in anticipation that I would be elected chair, I put some notes together just to kind of give a perspective. It's my hope that Jim and I will be kind of sharing duties. He's court the facilitator, but he and I will share duties back and forth. His job is to keep the meeting going, and I'll try to keep us focused on what our plan is today. I have three thoughts for this task force. One, I would ask you to be engaged. You were appointed to this task force because of your expertise, because of your knowledge, your skills, and your abilities to get to yes. So ask you to be engaged, be part of the process. We need to hear from each and every one of you. Be respectful of the opinions of others, even if they might disagree with what you might be thinking. Be open to exploring ideas that might be and probably will be out of the box. We're going to hear from Montana today, I think, and maybe some of their ideas were out of the box, and we're going to hear from others, but ask you to be open to ideas. I always believe, and that's why we've invited folks here today, life's too short not to steal good ideas from other people. And so we're going to hopefully steal some good ideas from other people across the nation about how to fund ODF&W. In summary, I believe in this room, you want what's best for ODF&W. We want to find potential alternatives and sustainable funding sources consistent with the legislative direction that was given in House Bill 2402. And let's always keep that in mind as we work through those issues. This meeting will be successful today if we achieve four things. Reach agreement today on the problem statement so we know and agree on what the problem we are trying to solve. I think the problem statement should be as short as possible, one or two sentences. The background to explain the problem statement would be an explanation of the common themes and observations that further explain the problem statement. But hopefully we can keep it fairly succinct and then use the background statement to explain it. Second would be a success if we gain some further understanding on what other states have done to address their funding issues. And we're going to get that started today with a couple presentations and also to hear from the Secretary of, the Audits Division from Secretary of State's office. So we're going to get a report on that too. Third is to gain an understanding of what was in the audit from the agency. I think some of the task force members talked about that. So we're going to gain an understanding of what was in the audit specifically to what our charge is. And then fourth, and definitely not last, but begin the process of developing our priorities and principles to guide our further deliberations in meeting three around those funding concepts and evaluation criteria that we will use to evaluate various funding options. In addition, focus on the priorities and principles that will guide the task force in our deliberations. So if we can achieve those four things today, I would consider this meeting a success today. So those are the four charges. Any questions on any of those? Comments?
Good.
Okay, thanks. When I talked to Jim about this, I'm a pretty open process person. And so last time we had public comment at the end of the meeting. And so There are folks today who have come, the audience is full, and you have very busy lives. Some of you may not be able to sit through the entire meeting today because we're going to be here for a while. We're not going to, we're going to spend some time. And so I asked Jim if he was okay with this, is having public comment at the beginning of the meeting and then also at the end of the meeting, so that folks that do want to say something to the group, we would allow you to have that public comment at the beginning of the meeting and at the end of the meeting. So is everybody okay with that, if we do that from now on? Mm-hmm. Okay. So public comment protocols. So, and I'll probably say this every meeting just to make sure that we're on track. We will try to limit your public comment to 3 minutes or less if possible, that you'd like to address with us. Please introduce yourself and indicate any group or entity that you represent, or if you're representing yourself, we'd like to hear that. And then comments should be directed to us, not to the general audience. I mean, you are giving us your advice, your opinions. We're not here to address the general audience about that. Remember what our charge is. So I'd ask you to keep your comments addressed to us if you would be so kind to do that. So we have one, two, three, four, five people that would like to provide some public comments to us. Blaine Ackley? Sir? Yes. Why don't you come on up? Why don't you come on up? You can stand, sir, or you can sit down, whatever you prefer. Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. My name is Blaine Ackley. I reside in Hillsboro, Oregon, and I sent you a letter that has the complete details of all that, some of the ideas I have for helping ODFW increase their sales for licenses. But I'd like to start out with a metaphor of a shopkeeper. And this shopkeeper has declining sales, and in the face of declining sales, raises the prices on the products he sells, and then, in addition to that, restricts the staff, reduces the staff. Well, if this owner came to us with this marketing plan, we would say, you're crazy. That's not going to work. But that's exactly what ODFW has done. And unless we, you know, expand our horizons and think in terms of marketing, I mean, at a time when Oregon's population is going up, sales of licenses are going down. That just doesn't make sense, you know. And we all have these things, and we all have computers. And I sign up, for example, to Travel Oregon, and I receive announcements from them every week. And I just bought my license, and they didn't ask me for my email address. And that would be a great way, just right there, for ODFW to make contact with people. And I sign up. The department does offer some nice resources, and I'd like those to continue. But, for example, people respond to incentives much better than increased prices. So imagine an incentive where a sporting goods company, when you go in to buy your rod and reel, they have a sale, and with that sale is included a fishing license. You know, whereas right now, I tell you, because I just did this, you go into Dick's Sporting Goods and you go to the special section where you buy your license, and the person selling you the license has no idea about fishing at all. Now, let's see here. Do you want your Columbia River endorsement? Now, you want your angler's license here. Now, do you want those together? I mean, she's really confused by what is going on. And I think if there were incentives for instance, for the commercial sellers of the license to establish, let's see, Dick's last year, just as an example, sold 100,000 fishing licenses, okay? So, and for this, they get a certain fee. But if you increase that by 50,000, you're going to get an extra fee as a result of that, extra part of the fee as a result of that. I bet you that if there's money to be made at the retail level, that clerk who sold me that license is going to know something about the licenses. They're going to say, they're going to clue this person in and say, hey, this is a revenue source for us now. This isn't just a service. And when there is a revenue source, I think that makes all the difference in the world. And, of course, there's the conservation stamp. You could sell more of those. There's all sorts of marketing things. But in closing, because of my limited time, my suggestion is for a cost-plus basis, you could hire a marketing firm that would develop a marketing plan and help the department to help itself and raise that money. And from the increased money that they would raise, I would bet that would pay for the cost of the marketing plan and firm. And we have multiple examples in Oregon to do this. Plus, we're one of the high-tech centers of the United States. I mean, we have a lot of creative, intelligent people here who can really help. And if they're just directed and have incentives to do so, I think they would.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Appreciate your comments very much. John Goodfell?
Yeah. I am John Goodell. I'm the Vice President-elect of the Goodell Society, which many of you know is representing over 300 wildlife professionals in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Make sure everybody can hear you, John. Thank you.
So I, as I mentioned, I'm John Goodell with the Oregon chapter of the Wildlife Society that represents over 300 wildlife professionals in the state of Oregon. And one of our mission and our goals of the Wildlife Society is to provide not just science advice and input to resource management issues, but also to address policy as well. And one of the issues after attending the last meeting was to address the issue of really, I think, shooting for the stars with your efforts here. I think it's many endeavors such as this, they can easily look at sort of, well, what are the line items that are existing now, and how could we maybe raise a little more money to plug this gap or plug that gap, or what are some of the programs that are lacking funding? But when you look at a state like Missouri with this comprehensive conservation sales tax or other similar broad-based funding systems that really bring in a large constituency from their citizens, I think you also see a transformative effect on the structure of the agencies and the way that they develop their programs. In other words, when I talked to Missouri and conservation administrator, the very thought of non-game wildlife program versus game was an insult. Like, they manage holistically. They manage based on what wildlife professionals would be considered modern resource science, modern wildlife management philosophy, which is holistic. We think of managing landscapes. We think of ecosystem function, resiliency. We don't see things as, of course, game versus non-game. That's just not the way modern wildlife science works. But, of course, we're captured by this legacy of the original funding mechanism, which for Teddy Roosevelt and, you know, Gifford Pinchot and George Bird Grinnell, hunters and fishermen were the only people they could use to monetize conservation. But we know that that's changed since then, and so I would just encourage the task force to really think in terms of that it's not just plugging the holes of what we know we want to fix, it's also the things we can't even imagine are going to be in the future. And I think by developing a broad-based system, it not only raises more money, it really transforms philosophy. It actually allows the agency to have their management system reflect modern science. We're all coming from the same universities, so we're all trained. There's not just two separate schools of thought on conservation. We're all coming from the same places, and the Oregon conservation strategy reflects that understanding. So I would, again, just encourage the task force to think big and realize that a broad-based funding mechanism could actually really transform this whole system.
Okay. Thank you, John. Appreciate your comments. Carol Finley? Carol?
No comments.
Okay. Alan Barker? Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Task Force Chairman and members, you got your work cut out for you. I'm glad you're up here, then not me. You know, there's a good variety of people up here. You've got a great group of resources here. My only comment that I'd like to make sure that I'd like to see happen is that I'd like to see that if you're going to draw funds from an entity like Fisherman, that those resources go back, those funds go back to that explicit source that you're drawing from. If you're going to raise money from Fisherman, improve the fisheries. If you're raising money from the hunters, goes back to the hunters. One of the things that was mentioned in some of the paperwork that's on the website was that Missouri succeeded by taxing without people being aware of it because it was broad-based and did not target a narrow group or interest. You know what? If I'm being taxed for something, I want to know where my money is going. I don't want taxation happening to me on something and me not being aware of where my money is going to go. I mean, I don't think it's right. One of the things that you could do, and I talked with the special plate program in the state here, we currently have 3,351,000 vehicles in this state that are owned by private citizens. And we've had custom plates before. We've seen our custom plates for different group that we all like. Why not expand on that a little bit and add a surcharge for that? I mean, right now with the House Bill 2730, it was passed last year. It takes 3,000 orders for a custom plate. I mean, that's not a whole lot of money to help a particular system if you only get 3,000, but it could be consistent, especially if you ask fishermen, 3,000 this year and cap it, 3,000 next year can do it. And then after that, let it grow, because then you're going to have a consistent of at least 3,000 every year. And depending upon the surcharge you put it, it can certainly help some of the incidental stuff that you're going to see as, you know, to plug some of the gaps. I would encourage you, like what Blaine Ackerman was talking about, you know, incentivize some programs for the retailers. When I was doing retail, if I could get a $5 spiff on something because I mentioned something to somebody else and filled out a form, I'd do it all day long. That's just an add-on for each individual salesperson. It doesn't cost the state that much for the amount of money that you're bringing in. Predation. I'm concerned about predation. The endangered species list that we see on a national level is not being corrected fast enough in the states. We see too much wolf and too much grizzly bear predation in our states. Our western states and our game is being slaughtered in some of our areas, in some of our counties, especially in eastern Washington and eastern Oregon. So I'd hope that you would address some of that if you can in the future. And I know that sometimes Fish and Game gets grants and things from the federal government, but there's strings attached to it. And as long as those strings are attached that don't allow Oregon to manage our fish and wildlife ourselves, because we know what's best. They don't. We're still going to be hurting.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, guys.
Appreciate your comments. Last is on the list, Bobby Cochran. Is it Cochran? Welcome, sir.
Thank you all for having me. I'm Bobby Cochran. I work for Willamette Partnership. We're a conservation coalition. It's kind of the core of who we are. And our mission is to expand the pay, scope, and effectiveness of conservation. But a long time ago, we realized there's no way we're going to do that unless we're able to create healthy business, healthy economies, and healthy communities at the same time. And so we've been working in a lot of different ways about how you can identify funding that's going to not as good stuff and move it to better stuff. And just a real, real coarse way. We've partnered with ODFW on its Greater Sagegrass Action Plan, looking at how we can access financing from energy. We've worked with ODFW on its Fish Passage Program, looking at how we can access money from the transportation side. We've worked with folks in Washington about accessing funds from development, and we've worked in Idaho looking at how we can look at wastewater investments into conservation. But I think for me today, you're going to hear me switch from conservation to talk about health. And I think a big reason we need to talk about, we've heard from the last couple of speakers, we need to look at expanding the pie and thinking about who's benefiting most from outdoor recreation, access to green space, and it may not be the traditional groups that we're used to serving. On the health side, if you talk actually to folks like Columbia or REI, the outdoor recreation industry, they're starting to talk about themselves as some of the oldest public health providers in the region. And if you look at public health overall, there's a base of evidence that's saying if you can spend more time outdoors in nature and in green space, you're seeing measurable improvements in physical activity, measurable improvements in mental health, social cohesion, and air quality, all of which have measurable improvements on health. And the reason I keep talking about health, I'm going to switch just straight into kind of the business side of this. Health is about 18% of GDP. If you look at all spending on conservation, it's way less than that. And so how do you figure out, if you're spending 18% on GDP and you have folks like Kaiser Permanente, the coordinated care organizations, and even the insurance folks serving public employees actively looking at preventative health, and they're all coordinated care organizations are already for Oregon Health Plan paying in some cases $60 a month per patient for a gym membership. If you're saying going out hunting and fishing can do the same thing for $50 a month, why shouldn't we have coordinated care organizations paying for hunting and fishing licenses? And these things are already happening. You have Kaiser Permanente has something called the Parks Prescription Program, where docs will write prescriptions to go outdoors. In Washington, D.C., doctors right in the office will have the ability to look up what outdoor recreation opportunities are there and say, go to this place, do this activity this often. You already have Family Care, which is a coordinated care organization in the Portland metro area, investing with schools to look at greening schoolyards. So the stuff is already afoot. And last fall, the Oregon Healthiest State, Willamette Partnership, the Oregon Public Health Institute, launched the Oregon Health and Outdoor Action Framework to talk about how do we get more people outdoors in a way that the healthcare industry can invest in. And I think the other piece of this, if you look at hospital financing across Oregon, I'm going to get a little geeky now, I apologize. It's basically if you look at kind of spending, and if I came into the emergency room and I had no healthcare, that basically coming in the front door, the hospital would have to pay for that. They're spending about $83 million less a quarter on that in Oregon than they used to. There's a huge surplus of potential funding in that arena. So I think in broad terms, looking at outdoor recreation, looking at connections to health, and I think Travel Oregon is already looking at paid time off initiatives, that as Americans, we leave a ton of our vacation time on the door or on the floor, and so using some of that. So I think final and closing, you have folks like CADA, you have folks like Tricia Tillman on this task force who know a lot about health, who know a lot about engaging rural Oregonians and communities of color, which are going to be essential. So thank you all very much.
Okay. Thank you, Bobby. So that's all I show that's on the list. Anybody else that would like to testify or provide comments now? Because we will have it at the end also. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate you making the time to come today for those who need to leave early, and appreciate your comments. So we have two other quick presentations. Brett's going to talk to us about the approach to the Tribal Consultation Task Force membership status, and then Roger's going to cover update on the National Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies Blue Ribbon Panel. So, Brett?
Okay. Thanks, Mark. So what I wanted to do is follow up on something from last meeting and something that is ongoing around how we are working with tribes related to this task force. And so that was, I thought, a great set of five perspectives, highlighting different things around what we're all thinking about here. And a lot of it relates to what do we do with an Oregon today and in the future that's different than an Oregon that existed, you know, when the current model was developed. Tribal people have been involved here on the landscape and with wildlife for a long, long, long time. And they are not on this task force, as is clear, but they are very much here in Oregon. And so I think they would be the first to tell you each tribe is its own sovereign nation. And so what we had in the legislative direction was the governor had 17 seats. There are 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. And each tribe being its own sovereign nation, it was pretty darn near impossible to think about how to have an individually represented person from each federally recognized tribe on the task force and still meet all of the other categories that are called out in the bill and stay within 17 seats. The other thing that we hear frequently from tribes is tribal consultation is not just talking to a tribe as part of a stakeholder table with a bunch of other stakeholders. This is a different sovereign relationship, and government-to-government relations are key in doing it early and often. So the approach that the governor has chosen to take on this is with the 9 federally recognized tribes, start the government-to-government conversation around this task force and the interests of tribes in fish and wildlife recreation, education, and what we're doing here. Do it at the government-to-government table, recognizing the state-tribal sovereign relationship, and also engage the tribes at the at the government-to-government table. Usually, that is meetings with tribal council members. There are also meetings at the state level through the Commission on Indian Affairs through different work groups. So there's a natural resources work group and a cultural resource cluster group. Staff from various tribes are there at that table. And so the approach is to engage around the subject matter of the task force with tribes at those two venues. And that's the approach. And so I wanted to just try to address it because I think it's come up through this task force. And while tribes aren't at this table, the conversation is happening. We had a meeting with the Umatilla tribe or Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Reservation last week. Didn't get into detail, but brought this up, and we're actively working to engage the tribes in this conversation. That's not to say that I just want to point out Fish and Wildlife and the department is doing, I mean, on an ongoing basis, I can't enumerate how many, but it's it's a lot of ongoing conversations and work with individual tribes around a whole lot of issues related to fish and wildlife. So Kurt and Roger, I think it's probably not for detail unless people really want to get into it here, but if you are interested in what the department is doing with tribes on an ongoing basis, it's documented. We can get into that, and Kurt and Roger can talk about it. But that's I think we wanted to address it up front here. Thanks, Jim. The other issue is.
Well, just any questions on that topic from any of the task force members regarding tribes? Okay, great. Thanks.
The other issue is there are 16 members of the task force at this point. The law, House Bill 2402 allows 17. The governor is actively engaged in filling the last remaining seat on the task force with somebody from east of the Cascades. She's been in a variety of conversations with different people who, unfortunately to date, some scheduling issues around people's availability haven't allowed her to fill that seat, but the intent is to get it done by the next meeting. And I think we've heard a bit from different channels so far about, hey, the geographic representation of this task force, it looks pretty interesting. And the makeup of the task force, people all seem generally impressed with you all. But there's this in certain people's minds, what about east of the Cascades? Where's the representation? So that's kind of the lens that we're looking through and that I'm talking to the governor about.
So the goal is to have somebody by the next meeting, is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. So any questions, comments on that?
Yes.
Yes.
Do you have a candidate in mind?
There are a few in mind that we're trying to narrow. There was a person that we were hoping would be able, and for a variety of reasons, they're not going to be able to do it. So there are a few others that, yeah, we are talking to. But I would say this, please talk to me at the break if there are people who you know about and you think would be great candidates.
Okay. Well, that's why I asked the question. Thank you.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Questions, comments on that? Okay, Roger, we've got the...
We're going to have Kurt.
Oh, Kurt's going to do it. I'm sorry. We've got the Blue Ribbon Task Force that's about done, I hear.
Yeah.
So.
I thought maybe since I lost my microphone that you...
Sorry.
Thanks. I'll be brief. So we mentioned at the last meeting that there was a national effort that had been convened by the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. That's known as the Blue Ribbon Task Force. That task force met several times over the last year. They concluded their meetings in, I believe it was in December. The last month or so, they've been finalizing a report with recommendations. We don't have a lot new to report publicly yet on their official recommendations. They will be releasing those recommendations on Wednesday of this week, March 2nd, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. The task force, and I think we mentioned this or maybe we didn't at the last meeting, was made up of 26 individuals, very broad base from business to conservation to fish and wildlife agencies, business both in the context of our traditional business constituents in the fish and wildlife world, but also other outdoor recreation business. Toyota Motor Corporation was actively engaged, as was Shell Oil. So that recommendation is going to be released here in just a couple days publicly, and we will be distributing that to you all when it does come out. I think, as John Goodell mentioned, they're truly shooting for the stars. This is a very big recommendation. This is a national effort, as you all know, not just focused on Oregon. I think as that recommendation is released, we will certainly be talking to you all about the ways that we effectively as Oregon and Oregonians engage in helping to move that proposal forward. And I think it's also, we expect that any new funding at the federal level, like our funding models, Pittman-Robertson and Dingell-Johnson, Wallet Breaux, those fundings all require a 25% state match. So even if when or if a new federal funding stream comes online, we will need to find a way to achieve the match. And the work of this task force may be a very important component of that. With that, Roger, did I leave anything off?
Questions?
We'll send that out to you here in the next couple of days.
Okay, questions? So one of the things going to be, I think, really important is there's likely going to be some congressional asks coming from this, and so we will need to be working our two senators and our representatives to do what we can to help support that for the best good for Oregon. So you can count me in to help whatever way I can to do that. So so before we move to the next topic, I just want to recognize Representative Krieger. He's got off the floor, and they are breaking now, and they're going to go back on the floor at 2:30, as I understand. And so he's a really busy guy, as we know, so he's probably going to leave us here shortly to get back on the floor to be voting on important matters to us. So I just want to thank you for making the time to come today to be with us for as much as you can. So appreciate it very much. Okay, so now let's move to stealing good ideas from other people. So, Jim, do you want to introduce?
Mr. Chair, first of all, for the audience, we encourage written comments at any time, and we will distribute those to all the members of the group. So public verbal comment is great. Written comments are great, too. We do have Wi-Fi for those of you with computers. the Wi-Fi is here and there's no password. And then I forgot to deal with the summary for our first meeting. We distributed a draft summary. We've had a few minor edits to that given to us. Instead of taking time now, if you have any other edits, just grab me and then we'll distribute a revised meeting summary for the first meeting. I thought Alicia did an excellent job capturing almost every word we said. So we're pleased to have the two Davids here. So we have David Chadwick from the Montana Wildlife Federation. Well, I got it right the first time. The Montana Wildlife Federation. And on the phone, we have David Thorne from the Missouri Department of Conservation. And our approach is these gentlemen have presentations they're going to give us, 15 or 20 minutes, and then we built in time for questions and discussion with you. We're going to go with David first, then we'll take a break to hear any questions you have of him. We'll bring on David Thorne at that point. When he's done as well, we'll have an opportunity for questions. Okay? And we will, at your March meeting, we have already lined up a representative from the Blue Ribbon Task Force to come and share with us in detail the recommendations of that process. So let me turn it over and get you a microphone.
Great. Thanks.
So, David, if you could maybe just give us a little bit of background on yourself before you actually start in the presentation.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
I'd be glad to do that, and thank you for inviting me here today. I am the executive director of the Montana Wildlife Federation, and MWF is the oldest wildlife conservation organization in Montana. We're one of the oldest in the nation. We were founded in 1936, and we work to protect Montana's abundant wildlife, habitat, and public access to the outdoors. And our members include hunters, anglers, photographers, wildlife watchers, people from all across the spectrum who enjoy and value Montana's fish and wildlife resources. Our members also include people from all over the nation, because one of the great things about Montana is people all over the world love Montana's fish and wildlife. I'd like to give a little bit of background on myself, though, because in addition to being executive director of the Montana Wildlife Federation, I've worked on these wildlife funding issues at the federal level and state level for a number of years. About a decade ago, I worked for the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, helping state fish and wildlife agencies develop the wildlife action plans, Oregon and the other 49 states plus the territories. And that was a truly historic effort to develop really the first ever inventory of what needs to be done to prevent our wildlife from becoming endangered. And also, I worked on lobbying Congress for increased federal funding. And a lot of what we've done over the last decade is laying the groundwork for the work of the Blue Ribbon Panel. So I think a lot of us are really excited to see what's going to happen in the next couple of days. And I think Director Melcher was right that there is a real prospect of something bold coming from the federal level that's going to demand a great deal more funding at every level for fish and wildlife conservation, which is a really exciting opportunity. I've also worked in state government. I worked for the Colorado Division of Wildlife for about 5 years before taking over the Wildlife Federation in Montana. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is not about Montana, because in the chair's spirit of stealing good ideas, we don't have it figured out yet in Montana, but we're stealing good ideas wherever we can find them. And so I'm going to talk about what has happened in several other states that have secured broad-based sustainable funding for fish and wildlife conservation, and some of the lessons that we're taking from that in Montana. But first, let me start with a question. What do we mean by sustainable funding? I know this task force is really familiar with the history and our current model of funding, in which our state fish and wildlife agencies are driven overwhelmingly by resources from one user group. And that has been a wildly successful model over the last century for restoration and conservation of some of our most treasured wildlife species. I think we also all are very aware that that model is hitting its limitations, that there is, even though the number of hunters and anglers is staying roughly constant, they're declining as a proportion of the overall population. And in addition, that funding model has had some unintended consequences about how agencies have done business. So I think we're all looking at ways to enhance how we do fish and wildlife conservation and how we pay for it.
David, could I ask a question? Is it okay with you if one of the task force member has a question as we go along to ask, or would you rather wait till the end?
I'm happy to be interrupted anytime.
Okay.
But I tend to talk fast, so if I talk over anybody, you may need to yell a little bit.
If you have a question,
yeah, jump in anytime.
Okay, great. Thanks.
And, you know, as one of your speakers earlier said, you know, we absolutely do need to market and maximize our hunting and fishing licenses, and we need to simplify our licensing system and generate as much revenue as possible from that funding source. But I think we also all realize, as another one of your guests earlier said, that we need to shoot for the stars. We need to go much bigger and build a much more sustainable fish and wildlife conservation model. So when I talk about sustainable funding, I think about several key elements. First, it needs to be comprehensive. It needs to provide for the full array of activities that are needed to conserve fish, wildlife, and that are needed to conserve the full diversity of our fish and wildlife. Everything from our big game and sport fish resources to declining non-game species. It needs to be enough to meet current needs, projected additional needs, and the unknown needs that might be out there. It needs to be reliable and something that'll stick around for a while. Ideally, it should be broad-based, and we move us away from this model of relying on a fee imposed on a single user group to fund an entire way of doing business. And then finally, I'd like to add that it should ideally be politically insulated. And I know everyone who works with public money and every government agency wants their funds to be politically insulated. I would argue that with fish and wildlife conservation, that's particularly important because the business of conservation takes so much time. We're not building things that you can appropriate for 2 years and then you have a new football stadium. We're talking about conservation efforts that take decades before you see results. And the only way that happens is through sustained effort and ideally by insulating that funding from political forces. So like I said, I'm not going to talk mostly about Montana. I'm going to talk about several states that have had a great deal more success than any of us in securing broad-based sustainable funding for fish and wildlife conservation. I'll talk a little bit about Missouri and their 1/8 cent conservation sales tax that was enacted in 1976 and fully funds their Department of Conservation. Although, since we're lucky enough to have David here, he'll talk a lot more about a few themes. So hopefully I'll introduce these and he'll tell us a lot more in greater detail. I'm also going to talk about Arkansas, which in 1996 enacted an 1/8 cent conservation sales tax, 45% of which goes to the Game and Fish Commission. Minnesota, which passed their Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment that dedicates 3/8 cent of their state sales tax for 25 years to a range of conservation activities. None of those funds are guaranteed to the Department of Natural Resources, but the department has, over the first few years, received a great deal of those funds. And then finally, Iowa, which enacted a 3/8 passed a ballot initiative to direct that 3/8 cent of the next sales tax increase passed by the legislature will go to conservation. So their fight is still ongoing. But under that plan, when that tax increase happens, 23% will go to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources for a range of activities, including fish and wildlife conservation. Two things I just want to put out right at the get-go. One is, all four of these examples involve sales taxes, but let's not talk about sales taxes. They all ended up going with sales taxes because that happened to be a viable funding option in those states. And those states have a very different political environment from, certainly from Montana, and arguably from Oregon as well, since you guys don't have a sales tax. Neither do we in Montana. I would bet politically you might have a slightly better shot than us in enacting one, but that's probably pretty slim too. So don't focus on the sales tax. Focus on the other themes. Yeah.
I have a question also. In those instances, are the departments similar to the structure that we have? In other words, do they have like a separate state parks? Do they have a separate land division?
None of them are similar.
We're pretty siloed, and
yeah,
so that's
this
the
is
question.
The beauty of fish and wildlife agencies is they're all a mess. In every one of these cases, fish and wildlife management and conservation activities do receive funding. In some cases, they're part of a Department of Natural Resources like they are in Minnesota and Iowa. In the case of Arkansas, they're an independent agency that just does game and fish conservation, although other portions of their conservation funding go into other activities, which I'll talk a little bit more about. And then, of course, the Missouri Department of Conservation stands out as really the gold standard of a politically insulated and fully funded wildlife conservation agency. Great. And then the other point I would just make is Success takes time in every single one of these efforts, and I'm going to talk about what happened in each of these campaigns, but I just remind everybody that Missouri took roughly 6 years, Arkansas 14, Minnesota 10 to 12, depending on when you start the clock. Iowa, I don't know, but I know it took a couple, and they're not done yet. So success at broad-based wildlife funding is not something that's going to happen in a year or two, and that's certainly the perspective that we're taking in Montana. So I want to talk through four big elements that I think, when we look at these examples, four big elements that really shine through of what we need to get the job done.
So I have just another question. So,
yeah.
Jim, do we have a copy of the PowerPoint presentation, or will we? So
yes.
Taking notes? Okay.
Sure.
Great. Thanks.
So I'm just going to go through each of these in turn and make reference to some of these successes in other states. First, you need a statement of need and a plan for what you're going to do with the money. You need a broad, diverse coalition that includes a lot of different interests. You need bipartisan political support, and you need an educated public that understands the need for action. I'll talk through each of these in turn. And you know, the first one is you need a plan. You need to say what you're going to do with the money. And as one of your speakers said earlier, anyone who's going to pay a tax wants to know what that tax is going to go to support. And even if you ultimately settle on a funding source that isn't a tax, the public that contributes to conservation wants to know how the dollars are going to be spent, and you can't convince them to spend the dollars until you tell them what you need the funds for. Missouri, of course, started the ball rolling and exemplifies this. You know, their design for conservation, which I know David will tell us more about, detailed down to the level of how many new wildlife management areas they needed to purchase, how much funding they needed to do for aquatic research. I mean, they lined it all out. They developed the most comprehensive plan you could imagine to fully realize the conservation and recreation mission of the Missouri Department of Conservation. I won't go into too much more detail because I know David will, but I'd like to also talk about Arkansas, because Arkansas really took the page right out of Missouri's playbook and designed their own plan for conservation. Like I said, it took 14 to 15 years, and it took two failed attempts to get the voters to enact their conservation sales tax. They developed a plan for conservation to outline what they needed the funds for. I think an interesting contrast between these two is, whereas Missouri's plan, I think it would be fair to say, was developed as more of a scientific or technical exercise, Arkansas's plan was developed really through extensive public engagement. They went out and asked the people of Arkansas, what do you want our agency to do? They did surveys of traditional agency users and of people who had no connection to the agency before. So they heard ideas like, we need more game wardens to enforce poaching laws. We need nature centers in every one of our urban communities. They put together this comprehensive plan for conservation that brought together the priorities of their traditional hunting and fishing constituents and everyone else who lives in Arkansas.
How did they do that survey? I mean, was it a contractor that they hired to go out and do these surveys? Or?
That I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
And I do know the agency did a facilitated process of town hall meetings. But it wouldn't be hard to find out exactly whether they did that with outside help or did it within the agency. I don't know within Oregon Fish and Wildlife what capacity the agency has to do human dimensions research, public opinion research. Yeah. So I think that's one of the exciting things about Arkansas. And, you know, I think the other great point of having a plan is, like I said, you can not only tell people what you need the money for, but you can let them know when you've delivered it. And I think it's really an impressive story that they passed their sales tax in 1996. The collection of the additional funds started in July of 1997. And on the day that new funds were going into the program, they swore in their first class of 30 new game wardens. 10 years later, not only did they have their new game wardens, 10 years later, they had nature centers. They had the original four nature centers they promised, and three more. Every major city in Arkansas has a nature center run by the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission to give people exposure to hunting and fishing, wildlife watching, other outdoor recreation opportunities. You know, I mean, it's really, it seems simple, but this idea of what's the shopping list? What do we need to spend this money on? And not just in this sort of detailed line item sense, but in the big picture. And I would just encourage the task force to think about what would be the best way to go about this exercise for Oregon. And I don't know if it's a task for this task force or if that's a recommendation to generate that list of needs. Yeah.
Was there an economic goal? Were there any economic thresholds or indicators that they were trying to achieve?
Oh, I don't know. In terms of like the economic benefits,
yep,
of their
any more wildlife viewers, any more people going into and purchasing outdoor equipment?
I don't know.
But basically, was there any specific economic thresholds and indicators that they wanted to achieve when they were going out?
Yeah, I don't know, but I do think that would certainly be, and it's certainly something we emphasize in Montana, is how much it drives our state's economy. And I would think you could make a similar case here in Oregon of how fish and wildlife conservation and management activities drive the economic activity. And then Bobby spoke earlier about the health sector spending, and I think again there you could easily see how the spending, how additional funding for wildlife conservation could translate into those activities too.
And then, yeah, the second part was, were there any, as part of the surveys, any thresholds or indicators of who was taking advantage of the outdoors? And in other words, did they include an equity and inclusivity component to how they reached, the population, and were there thresholds and indicators and sort of qualitative kinds of things for that component?
I don't know the level of detail, but I do know at the broad level, in the case of Arkansas, and I'm sure David can speak to Missouri later, in the case of Arkansas, there was a very concerted effort to say that we as an agency want to reach into our urban centers that have not traditionally been constituents of the Game and Fish Commission. And I just think this idea, I mean, if we could have seven nature centers in Montana's biggest cities, and when you go down the list, seven cities down, you're not talking about a very big city, but that would be phenomenal and transformative, and we're not a particularly urban state. So I want to keep moving along, because I'm sure I'm already taking up more time than I deserve. But I want to talk about the next point of a broad coalition. Anybody recognize this photo? Yeah, Spoon Bridge and Cherry in the Minneapolis Sculpture Garden at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. And I put it up there because it's both a great iconic symbol of the state of Minnesota, but also because it really illustrates one of the key factors in how Minnesota successfully enacted a conservation sales tax. And it's a long, tortured story, but fish and wildlife conservation, the original proposal in the early 2000s for a sales tax to fund fish and wildlife conservation did not get a lot of political traction in Minnesota. And that was because of some lingering bad blood over the passage of a right to hunt amendment in 1998. Which no one opposed substantively. What they were mad about was how that turned out a whole lot of angry voters who elected Jesse Ventura governor. The Minnesota Democrat Farmer Labor Party was not a big supporter of fish and wildlife conservation at that point. And in more sharp institutional terms, it happened that in order for this proposal to get referred to the voters, had to get through the legislature. The chair of the tax committee was Senator Larry Pogemiller from Minneapolis, an urban core senator. The chair of the Minnesota Senate Finance Committee was Senator Dick Cohen, who was also from an urban part of St. Paul and had a long history with the arts community in Minnesota. There's a long story about how the deal got struck, but ultimately they ended up packaging the arts in with their fish and wildlife conservation and outdoor recreation proposal. And this proved to be both politically expedient. It also proved to be extremely useful from a public marketing standpoint, because both the outdoors and the arts are really defining characteristics of the state of Minnesota. And so what they ultimately ended up with was a program that provides about a third of the funds to outdoor heritage conservation, including fish and wildlife, and about 20% for arts and cultural heritage, creating public art all over the state and really becoming sort of a point of pride. And, you know, one of the quotes from, I believe it was from Senator Dick Cohen, who made the comment that this is about Minnesota, you know, that they bring this broad coalition together, they hook up, and there was another great line about the crowd of, you know, guys with orange hats and ear flaps and guys with berets all lining up on the same side of the fence. And I think it's just a great story because It really reminds us that we need to build a big tent. Another great example of building a big tent was in Iowa. You know, when they passed their first proposal to dedicate future sales tax funding in 2010, they had a 62.8% yes vote. And what they did in Iowa to build this broad coalition was married together fish and wildlife conservation and outdoor recreation concerns with agricultural concerns. And they included a sizable element of funding for soil and water conservation. And when you look at the campaign materials from Iowa, I would never think that agricultural soils would be such a big selling point, but that's all over, and it's because that's a hugely important thing to Iowans. The proposal they ultimately came up with dedicates 23% of funds to the Department of Natural Resources and about another 30% to a variety of soil and water conservation programs administered by the DNR and the Department of Agriculture. And as a result, their campaign had a strong coalition that included everybody from Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, to the Nature Conservancy, Iowa Audubon, the Iowa Corn Growers, the Iowa Soybean Association, and the Iowa Farmers Union. That's powerful stuff. And to be able to build something that has that kind of support, that's what gets it over the finish line. And again, I don't know exactly what situation would work best here in Oregon, but I would encourage you to think about what are the big tent political coalitions, what are the marriages you can make that can get fish and wildlife and outdoor conservation over the line. I think the compelling example we heard earlier of working with the healthcare sector, I know when you look at polling data for issues that are of concern to Oregon voters, schools are at the top of the list. Is there some opportunity to marry up education and conservation? I don't know. I know when you look at conservation issues, Oregonians care a great deal about water quality and about beaches. We don't worry about beaches in Montana, but it seems to me that there could be some compelling opportunities for coastal conservation. I don't know what it looks like, but building a big tent, I think, is what's important. Next big theme, and this should be number three. I don't know why that says number two. Oh, they all say number two. I'll just tell you that ahead of time. Sorry. Bipartisan political support. And I think this one kind of goes without saying, and we know this is true with everything. Ideally, you want to have bipartisan support. I think Arkansas is a particularly good example of this because during the 14 years it took to get their conservation sales tax enacted, a lot of political changes happened in Arkansas. Probably the most dramatic was in July of 1996 when their governor, Jim Guy Tucker, resigned after he was indicted. And the lieutenant governor took over. Arkansas is one of these states where your lieutenant governor and governor can be of different parties. The lieutenant governor at the time was somebody nobody knew, this anti-tax Baptist minister, Mike Huckabee, who we all know well now. At the time, nobody knew who he was, and nobody knew what he thought about conservation. But because the supporters of Arkansas's conservation sales tax had done their homework and had worked aggressively with Republicans and Democrats in their legislature, with the governor and the lieutenant governor down the line, barely a few weeks after Governor Huckabee took over, he announced his strong support for the initiative. And in fact, in September of that year, he ended up doing a boat tour of the Arkansas River on his bass boat with a whole flotilla of media and staff following him, sort of a whistle-stop fishing trip that a lot of people involved in the campaign really credit as being one of the pivotal moments that got them over the finish line. And we could talk a lot more about other examples, but I just think that's a really compelling one that reminds us we need to work in a bipartisan way, and we need to talk to everybody, not necessarily just the people who might be in power right now. This is the third number two, a broadly educated public. All four of these examples happened at the ballot box. I don't know if that needs to be true everywhere. I don't know if that needs to be true here in Oregon, but a broadly educated public is important to anything happening at the ballot box and anything that happens in the legislative process. Of course, public employees, the employees of the agencies, can't lobby the public, but what they can do is educate the public about the needs and educate the public about how the money will be spent. And that brings us back to the first point of a good plan. When you look at Arkansas and Missouri, what you see is situations where, because they had a good plan, the agencies could talk about the issue without engaging in illegal political activity. And that's hugely powerful. And in fact, one great quote from David Goad, who was with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, we talked to every Lions Club, Kiwanis Club, and Canoe Club in the state about how they were going to spend the money. They didn't do any illegal campaigning, but they talked about the plan, why the funds were needed, and what the funds would go with. And I guess I would just encourage, and I want to move along because I'm already talking too long, but when talking to the public, this is where it's hugely important to talk to them, to meet them where they are, and talk to them about what's important. And over again, if you look at polling in Iowa, you see a strong message about clean water, future generations. You look at polling in Minnesota, you see strong messaging about clean water and future generations. And anyone who's been in the conservation business, particularly on the campaign side, will tell you, and I know you've experienced this here in Oregon with passage of land conservation measures, that talking about clean water, health, and future generations is hugely important. So thinking about how those elements play into a broadly educated public. And then I also just want to throw up as another point to think about, and you can't see the detail here, but these are the percentages of yes vote by county for Missouri's conservation sales tax. And you see the highest vote in two places, Kansas City and St. Louis, and the lowest vote in the rural areas. One of the political realities is that the constituents who support fish and wildlife conservation tend to be rural and conservative and not supportive of more government spending. Urban residents tend to support government spending more. It's hugely important that we talk to everyone in our states if we want to get any of these things over the finish line. So a statement of need and a plan, a broad coalition, bipartisan leadership, and an educated public. I want to talk about what we are doing in Montana. And we're not far along in this process. I don't think we're as far along as you are here in Oregon. But we're making steps in broadening funding for our own agency. Just to hit a few highlights. And this image here, I think, is important because this is an image of the Rocky Mountain front. And about a year and a half ago, we had a major conservation win in Montana when we saw the protection of the Rocky Mountain front, the designation of the first new wilderness in Montana in 30 years with bipartisan political support. Our Democratic and Republican senators to this day argue with each other about who got this bill passed. Broad support from agricultural landowners in the local area, local communities, environmentalists, sportsmen, people from all over the state of Montana came together to protect the Rocky Mountain front. And so I think it's a great image to think about how we protect our fish and wildlife resources as well as we protect our public land resources. A couple things we've done over the last few years. We did have a task force, somewhat like this one, that looked at our hunting and fishing licensing system and looked at simplifying our licenses, generating more revenue to cover short-term projected needs. That process also identified the clear need for broader sustainable funding and going beyond just licenses and suggested that we need a future task force in Montana to address that effort. We have the 15 and forward strategic planning process that the agency has recently wrapped up, which really underscored that the mission of the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is broadly conserving all of the state's fish and wildlife resources for all Montanans and ensuring that all Montanans have an opportunity to enjoy them. And that huge broad vision is important to moving forward with sustainable wildlife funding. We just revised our state wildlife action plan, which I don't know what the status is here in Oregon, but most states are in the process of revising those now. So we're putting the pieces in place for assembling the plan of how, of what we need funding for. We also, our agency also used to be on a 10-year cycle of reevaluating our finances and our fishing, hunting and fishing license scale. That's been shifted to a 5-year cycle, so we should have a shorter time horizon for future financial planning. So we're taking steps towards getting that plan in place. On the coalition building side, I think we have a couple of things going on. I know you've been provided materials from our Finding Common Ground discussion, which is about many of these same themes and has brought together a group of interests that would not have been in the room together a couple of years ago, from the agricultural side, from, of course, the hunting and fishing side, also some strong advocates, non-hunting advocates for predator conservation in Montana. I mean, these are contentious groups of people who would not have been in the same room a few years ago. And I'm a pretty impatient guy. I don't know if we made enough progress in having those discussions, but if we have this 10 to 15 year time horizon, I think we started some really important discussions. I also want to highlight that one of the things we're doing at the Wildlife Federation is a lot more outreach to our Montana's agricultural producers and private landowners, because one of the things we see in Montana is a huge level of public concern with the loss of family farms and ranches. And I think there's no way, personally, there's no way we're ever going to get over the finish line on conservation if it doesn't marry conservation of Montana's agricultural heritage with Montana's outdoor heritage. A couple final thoughts, and nobody's cutting me off yet, so I better get them. Okay, a few really quick things. One is, and you can't see this too well, but this is a screenshot of the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission's website, and the photo there is David Goad, who was deputy director, who actually passed away a couple years ago in a car accident. I took this screenshot a few years before that, but I think it's great to think about, and the little photo feature there is about how cooler weather is here, so it's time for squirrel hunting, which I think is a good reminder that this is an agency that has broadened its funding and has not stepped one inch away from their traditional hunting and fishing constituents. I think we'll see this, and we'll hear the same thing, I'm sure, from David about Missouri. These agencies have broadened their funding. They're no longer dependent on one user group to fully fund the agency, and they are just as dedicated as ever to that user group and to everyone else who values the fish and wildlife resource. Final message, give people hope. We're all focused on the fact that we're running out of money and that we see all these lines pointing downward. I'd take it back to our political polling, where what we see over and over again is when we talk to the public, let's talk about the positive opportunity to keep what we have for future generations. Let's not dwell in what we're losing and the threat and the money we're running out of. Let's talk about how we give people hope, because that's what makes them support long-term conservation. So that's kind of a whirlwind tour of some of our thinking and some of what we're doing in Montana, hopefully building on some of the lessons that we've learned from other places. And I would just encourage you, hopefully I've been able to provide some good ideas for you all to consider. And I would also just encourage you to relentlessly and shamelessly steal ideas wherever you can find them.
Okay. Sure. Just a couple comments, Kenji?
Sure. Quick question. You said that you did work in Colorado, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the Colorado did a agency consolidation between their wildlife and their parks. Do you have any insight into that or some comments into what happened?
I would say on this funding piece, the better lesson from Colorado is the Great Outdoors Colorado Initiative, which dedicated lottery funding for wildlife conservation, land protection, outdoor recreation infrastructure. And the merger that happened a couple years ago, I was in the agency when the merger happened. There was some talk about bringing those agents, the Parks Agency and the Wildlife Agency, together as a way of talking to a broader audience, introducing sort of both of those agencies to getting folks who work in the parks world to talk to hunters and anglers more, and getting the Wildlife Agency to talk to people who don't hunt and fish more. So that was certainly part of the motivation. I don't know if, in my experience, the administrative nightmare of merging two state agencies, I think, probably outweighed any political benefits, but I guess we'll see how things unfold.
But in terms of also like creating that broad coalition, if a tax comes up, tax that benefits both perhaps parks and ODFW would be something that could broaden the coalition?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, and that's the lesson everywhere. I mean, that was Arkansas was just as much about funding state parks as it was about funding game and fish.
Jim.
You know, Dave, I think this is an excellent summary. It's very similar to the summary that we've done in Pure Fishing as well. Came up with some of the same conclusions. You know, last time we had our task force, we were kind of asking the question, what's the need? What's the target here? And that what came back to us was we would need this much money to avoid cutting-based program and not to have to increase the next license, the next projected license increase. And I think what I'm hearing from you is that can't be the way you characterize the goal. the characterized the goal has to be a much bigger vision about what Oregon and Oregon's relationship with its wildlife and what healthy communities need and what healthy watersheds need, and a lot less about, well, we just need to tweak things a little bit so we don't have to raise the hunting fishing licenses next and we don't have to cut the agency. Because that's essentially the agency on the brink is a negative message. It's not going to engender the kind of broad coalition. It's not going to engender the kind of big step forward that's going to have to create a whole new business model. I just couldn't agree more. And that's why I thought that the public testimony we got about think bigger, think broader, think longer term, think bolder makes sense to me. Because if we think about just avoiding internal budget cuts in ODFW, we're going to have the same kind of dynamic we usually have at Ways and Means, which is, well, which budget cuts, you know, are most important to avoid, and how can we take a minimalist, just barely get over the line point of view, guaranteeing that we have the same discussion in the next Ways and Means and the same kind of counterproductive, what do you like more, deer hunters or fishermen or environmentalists or whatever. You know, we got to break out of that. We got, if we're going to do something big, we got to have a bigger vision. And the second thing I heard, which I, my boss is on the big blue ribbon panel, the number one thing they concluded is it's going to take a campaign. Everything you said there is it's going to take a campaign. And everything you said is you run into a couple setbacks before you ever get there with a campaign. So you better have the broad coalition, the hell of a public relations effort. You better have a bigger vision, and you better have a lot of patience because it's going to take a campaign.
And you might lose a couple times. And you shouldn't plan to lose, but it'll probably happen.
But expect setbacks, right? So I think those things are very important. They're very consistent with the analysis that we've done of all the different efforts across the country. They're very, very common elements.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why you invited me. Jim knows this stuff better than I do. But, I think you're absolutely right. And I guess the one thing I would just add, too, is I think that when you – and people are often, particularly people in agencies, uncomfortable talking about campaigns, understandably, because it's illegal. But that's where you need to find this opportunity of what this is where you keep bringing it back to what's the plan and what's the vision and what can people in agencies talk about, not just ODFW, but also state parks and other agencies.
If I could just interrupt you just for a second, Representative Helm, I just want to thank you. I fully understand you're on the floor in about 30 seconds, so appreciate you coming in just for that short period of time. We appreciate it very much. So, okay, thank you, sir. Okay, I'm sorry, Dave, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that, I mean, I think this is where when you have that real clear, concrete, bold vision for what you want to do, that's something that the agencies can talk about. And leave it up to everybody else to build the political support.
Right.
So, Jim, thank you. Because, I mean, you've seen this with a lot of different hats on, and what you said, I think, was great. I'm curious, so from the nonprofit end of things, knowing, you know, so Wildlife Federation, Montana Wildlife Federation has kind of hook and bullet roots. How has this issue kind of transformed the nonprofit sector and the organization?
Yeah, and I'll say from the Wildlife Federation's perspective, our roots are in the hook and bullet world. We're an organization founded by hunters and anglers. We also have a very strong vision to this day that there's no divide between people who hunt and fish and people who don't hunt and fish. You know, I joked with my last board chair, there are certain times of the year when he is shooting an elk with a gun, and there are certain times when he's shooting it with a camera. He's the same guy. The same values and the same motivations get him outdoors. And that's true of most of the people in our organization. Now, I know that we don't necessarily, there are other organizations that have a different point of view, but we've always been a big tent organization, and that's why this issue is so central to us, because we really do want to support the Fish and Wildlife Resource for everybody who benefits from it.
Okay, I think we need to move on. Appreciate you coming all the way here from Montana to spend the time with us. Are you going to be around for just a little bit when we maybe have a break? Somebody, if anyone wants to talk to you separately?
Absolutely. I'll stay around for the rest of the meeting.
Okay. So let's move to the other David. David Thorne, are you on?
Yes, this is David. Glad to be here.
Okay. Maybe get the mic just a little bit closer. Let's see. What is it? Is it 5:30 where you are right now?
4:30.
Okay, so I don't feel too bad then. It's still not past 5 o'clock. So if you could just introduce yourself for a little bit and then tell us about the great state of Missouri and what you're doing there.
I'd be glad to. My name is David Thorne, I'm the policy supervisor for what we call our policy coordination unit in our administration director's office. I've been with the department 25 years and have worked all in human dimensions, planning, policy, environmental policy kind of issues after finishing a PhD, which now seems like a long time ago, at Purdue University in Indiana. And what I'll go through is just a little bit about our department, although Dave set up many of those kinds of comments, so you'll know what I'm saying. Talk about how our funding works, a little bit about connections to other things, the department's broad obligations, citizen support, relation to another tax that's key for us in our state called the Parks and Soils Tax, and then provide some insight on the Missouri experience for what I think you're trying to do there in Oregon. And can you hear okay? Is this satisfactory?
Yes, you're coming in loud and clear.
Great. So the conservation sales tax that we talk about in Missouri has been in place since July 1 of 1977. It was voted by the citizens in 1976 after being placed on the ballot by citizen petition. And while that's important, it's also important to know that the Conservation Commission's authority and the establishment of the department was created in 1936 by citizen vote, also placed in the Missouri Constitution and also carried as a citizen initiative petition. The commission, there's quite a bit of language about that in our Constitution, no more than two from any political party, so it is relatively non-political, although that still has some bearing at times. We're not ever immune from that. But the power of having that citizen initiative and then placing both of those items in the Constitution is a very important place for us to be at in terms of long-term sustainability of the department and the funding. The funding, the sales tax does not have a sunset, although frequently in my career as well as previous to that, whether for the department's authority or the sales tax, there have been initiatives on the part of our General Assembly to either remove the sales tax or divert it other places. So those are always situations that can occur, and we work with the citizenry to try to head that off when we can, but we're not immune from that discussion. As we think about the funding timeline, the department, after in the 30s, of course, after the Depression, the Dust Bowl in the Midwest, the lack of fish and wildlife, it was estimated we had fewer than 2,000 deer in the state. 4,000 turkeys probably was the biggest number across the state. Folks were just really concerned about the loss of resources. The Ozarks, southern Missouri, had been cut over pretty extensively, and with those shallow, hilly soils, a lot of erosion had occurred, and so there was a heightened public opinion about the loss of resources, and that set the stage for the citizens to start the department. They just, the initial 30s, 40s, even into the 50s, the focus was on just bringing back fisheries, forestry, wildlife back to Missouri. And it wasn't until the late 60s, really, that folks began to say, what's the next step? And I heard that in Dave, his presentation, as he described all the states, perhaps as you've described your situation in Oregon. What's the next step? We've been doing good work, but we want to do more, and where do we go? And in Missouri, an outside program review was established, and four experts, you'll recognize at least one of the names, A. Starker Leopold, the oldest son of Aldo Leopold, who at that time was with the University of California at Berkeley, and then Irving Fox from the Water Resources Center in Wisconsin, and Charles Callison, who was executive vice president of the National Audubon Society. They put together a review of the department and looked at overall where we were at, what they thought the needs were in the state, and you heard that term need from Dave also, and then they came up with a recommendation, and I won't go into those details, just the fact that they had that program review, and the department then responded and then started to think about what's the next step, and then as Dave described to you, the next step was to consider additional funding and then how to start. a little more detail then is the department asked an outside consultant in the University of Missouri to look at what funding opportunities might be possible. And they reviewed everything from soft drink taxes, other taxes, bonds, user fees, a variety of user fees, mineral extraction taxes, other kinds of mostly taxes, but ways of generating revenue. And they finally decided on a soft drink tax and carried petitions in the citizens did in 1971 through 72. And as those petitions were carried throughout the state, they had left off the wording at the top of the page that was what we call the enacting clause, be it so enacted or placed, you know, in the Constitution. And because the soft drink bottling industry was so opposed to the sales tax on a soft drink per carton or bottle at the time, that they finally found that, and then the petition was, although it was ruled valid in terms of the number of signatures, it was thrown out because of that procedural clause. And that's an important point that I'll bring up in the insights a little bit, that having that group that opposed it was a major obstacle. Now, in the long run, it may have been the best thing that occurred, because the citizens regrouped in the 1972. The Our Citizen Conservation Federation determined to go for a general sales tax, a dedicated sales tax, in 1974, and then took that program review response, which they developed, and turned that into what they called the new design for conservation, which, if you don't have it, I think Jim has the PDF of the special edition of our magazine from August 1975 that has the 22 items, some with maps of proposed locations, that had dollar amounts and what the department was going to do. And some of those areas were, upland wildlife or conservation education services, which included a system of conservation interpretive centers, or traditional topics like forest research or aquatic research. Anyway, 22 items with dollar amounts, and then they carried the petition. And then, of course, it was successful in passing in 1976, although just with a 50.8% margin, just barely over 50%. So what the sales tax is it's an eighth of 1 cent sales tax on all taxable items, and that includes food. The Missouri general tax rate is 4.225%, and that includes 3% general revenue, 1% for education, the eighth of a percent for conservation, and then a tenth of a percent for a separate parks and soils tax, and I'll mention that in just a moment, too. The tax rate on food only includes the education, conservation, parks and soils, and the local rates, which vary. So we have only there's no general revenue from food items, so there's a split kind of sales tax there across the state. Now, an interesting side note is that last year on the ballot, the citizens rejected an increase in our gasoline tax for roads, and there doesn't seem to be a high level of support for funding roads right now with additional taxes, whether dedicated or general. And I don't know what that means for our tax, but it's just a different place to be at this current time. Language was added in our Constitution in 1980, soon after the passage of the sales tax, that would pay in lieu of taxes on all lands that we've acquired since the passage of the sales tax, which for us has been 500,000 to 600,000 acres that we've acquired since then, and we still pay then an in lieu of tax payment, which was a critical component and has continued to be critical to ensuring some political support of land acquisition. The sales tax generates about $100 million each year, and only one time since the passage of the tax have we had any declining trends, and that was in the 2008 to 9 time frame, and we did go through a position reduction exercise and eliminated about 11% of our workforce, 174 positions. We did that through a long-term strategic kind of focus where we eliminated tasks and work rather than positions, and then let that sort itself out, and we gave any positions that were terminated. We gave the people 18 months to find a new job in the department, and we ended up only having to terminate 20 positions or folks because, you know, they didn't want to move or had a spouse that didn't want to move or they took a job outside the departments. But it does point out that, and it'll be another point that I'll make, is that long-term sustainable funding is important because it may go up and down a little bit, and just like any organization, you may have to adjust. It's unclear to us right now what the impact of internet sales is on reducing the sales tax. Our statewide Office of Administration makes some projections, but it's difficult to know, and yet what seemed like a, you know, it would never go away in terms of a sales tax, that the internet wasn't around in 1976. So changes in technology and society do have some impact on that long-term sustainability of the funding. The sales tax for us is about 60% of our revenue, and then permit revenues make up about 18 to 20%. The federal reimbursements, about 15%, and we have some sales and rentals and a few other smaller, much smaller sources. The commission does retain a fund balance of about 2 months of operating expenses, but the important thing in terms of the sales tax is we do receive no general revenue from the state, and yet all of that, the department budget's less than 1% of the total state budget, just hardly registers. The sales tax funds the broad obligations of the department, and we cover everything from fish, anything with forestry, and all wildlife. And that would include invertebrates and insects, although we have we don't do some enforcement with insects, certainly not agricultural-oriented kinds of things, but it is a very broad constitutional requirement. And then the interesting thing for us is that language in the Constitution of a commission, and then they hire a director, really follows the 1930 game policy that Aldo Leopold and a committee set forth and probably was the model for some of that language. We do experience in Missouri a very high level of citizen support. Obviously, they carried the petitions, but we do current surveys with outside organizations, and it's some internal work, and we know that about 95% folks right now say that they have some interest in fish, forests, and wildlife. We have a pretty high level of trust. About three-quarters of the Missourians say they trust the department. About 70% support land acquisition, and a really important number for us is 89% say they support protecting outdoor places, even if they don't plan to visit the area, and that's sort of that broad tent that Dave Chadwick was talking about. For comparison, the Missouri Parks and Soils Tax was established in 1984. It's been renewed 4 times, and now it's renewed on a 10-year basis, and in fact, it will come up for renewal this November. And it's had a high level of support because of the its soil and water conservation. That's where the soil and water conservation districts and funding is allocated. And then state parks and historic sites have a high level of support. And so they're anticipating that would be renewed. So some observations and what we think is success as we think about funding options. Certainly for us, as you heard Dave talk about, citizen support and initiative. That creation of the department would not have been possible without citizens carrying the petitions, and certainly the funding initiative would not have been possible, especially with the one failed attempt where they then regrouped and started over on you know, what was the best approach to take. The department, not in 36, but certainly up prior to 76, since 1938, we've provided a free monthly magazine, and the keyword's free, for any Missourian adult that requests it. We'll send them a monthly Missouri Conservationist magazine, and now that subscription level is over 550,000 per month. We have a children's version with an online component that goes to about 175,000. We think that magazine reaches, well, we know it reaches a quarter of the households in Missouri, because that's the subscription level. They pass it on or they see it in the doctor's office, and we, from our surveys, estimate that, probably half of the Missouri households at some point see that Missouri magazine. So we have that connection to carry a brand name and information about the outdoors. We do a lot of work to be in touch with Missourians. And, for example, last year we had 129 separate kind of efforts, surveys, public meetings, focus groups, open houses, something where we received comments, and we heard from over 75,000 people. Now, if you understand how surveys work, you know, we mailed out hundreds of thousands of survey kinds of forms, but we actually heard from about 75,000 people just last year. And so we feel that that's a very important technique to keep in touch with what Missourians want and what they're thinking. We certainly, as you heard Dave said, have support across the geographic range of Missouri, and particularly in 36 and certainly in 76, urban and suburban areas carried the high levels of support for conservation. Rural folks, as we've done some scoping of that, they either felt in 36 that they had adequate opportunities, and in 76 they certainly felt that way and just didn't want more government. But the urban, suburban, and the more non-traditional kinds of users probably carried, you know, the tipping point to get over the percentage to pass those. The answer, as we hear it continually, and it sounds like you've discussed that, if dedicated anglers or hunters are concerned about expanded programming that might divert funds, certainly that has not been our case. That broad coalition, the expanded sales tax funding, it's an investment in their interests, and they have more money dedicated to hunting, fishing, traditional pursuits than they had before, and we wouldn't have the sales tax without that urban, suburban, and much broader approach to wildlife viewing, or simply, as you heard me talk about, the support for areas, even if people don't plan to go there, just the idea that somebody's taking care of conservation, that it's protected for future generations, is a very important topic for many Missourians, and they're willing to support conservation because of that. We would suggest that a big part of the success is that we tied money to what we were going to do in that design for conservation, and that continues. I know I provided Jim with a copy of our current conservation priorities document, and we continue to feel that identifying those important priorities, now we have just six, and then connecting that with money through our expenditure plan is really important to connecting and retaining our funding. We would suggest that funding alternatives should be evaluated by criteria that include how much money should be generated and for how long. Who would have dreamed of the internet in the 60s and 70s, and that it might reduce a sales tax? There's an example where hard to predict that kind of thing, but also, if there's organized opposition, like with the soft drink tax, you're just not going to get anywhere. That's a huge obstacle, and the sales tax initiative petition that was validated with signatures, of course, was thrown out because a group opposed it. So if you can include more people, a broader coalition, there are fewer obstacles, less likely that it would be torpedoed or removed or fail for some reason. And we'd like to think that since all benefit from that public trust of the outdoors and conservation, it's reasonable to ask all to support it. That design for conservation and the sales tax, and you heard Dave say this, it was both a effective strategic plan and the foundation for an extensive marketing and communication campaign. And obviously it took several years to carry that message. And we still feel that that approach to education and information is exceedingly important to retaining the tax. Having key messages, strategic conservation priorities, all are ways to engage Missourians and talk about the importance of the outdoors. And a consistent message that we've had from outside consultants since 1976 has been, well, the one that happened early in the 70s, we looked at that design for conservation plan, and the consultants told us to get rid of the the campaign name and focus on our brand name, that the design for conservation confused people. They didn't know what the difference between that and the department was. And so even in recent outside communication audits or reviews, folks continue to tell us that the brand of the Department of Conservation is important, and that's what we need to continue to connect with those accomplishments, the dollars that are spent, so that we can help develop those emotional connections with the department or the outdoors, and that then increases people's awareness or interest, and obviously then that helps them continue their support for conservation outcomes and funding. But that idea of brand awareness and not diluting. At one point, we had a whole variety of logos based on our triangle, everywhere from hunter education to school programs, and now we're pulling that in so that we have a single department brand or logo, Department of Conservation, to make sure that connects with people, that this is who's doing the work, along with partners and along with themselves as citizens, to make a difference. That summarizes my comments. I'd be glad to do my best to answer questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions? Comments?
Well,
yes, go ahead, Mayor.
Well, it's just a comment, and that is, the metro metro region of Oregon has been really successful in two or three campaigns for, open spaces with the messages of clean water and a healthy environment and access to nature. And so I would just say, we should think about the success and all the best practices that campaign has used, as well as other campaigns that have been successful.
Okay.
I've got a question. So you're talking to a Missouri boy here. I grew up in Missouri, and I can tell you that their program is excellent. I grew up reading the magazine that he referred to, and I have a question about the magazine. Does the magazine pay for itself through advertising? Because it is an incredibly effective tool. I still remember it to this day. There was always a copy of it in our house. It was always a copy of it in my grandfather's house. Everywhere you go, Missouri State Conservation Department did a great job of outreach and promoting themselves. And I just can't speak highly enough about it. It's a great part of living in Missouri. But I am curious about does it pay for itself?
There is no advertising in the magazine, and it's, as far as I know, never had advertising. It's all about the department information or education. Our staff tell us that it costs about 38 cents. A copy to mail, print and mail that magazine, and for five, the print runs around 600,000, and so you can expand that up to a dollar figure. Now that doesn't include our staff and the overhead. That's just the printing and mailing costs. So we probably spend well over $1 million a year on the magazine, but there is no advertising, and it's all focused and about the department and the outdoors.
Other questions? So, yes, Brett.
Dave, this is Brett Brownscomb. Quick question about we had a commenter here talk about, this relates to culture. So in Missouri, within the department, the comment was talking about game versus non-game isn't necessarily something that goes on. And I'm curious to know just, it was a while ago in terms of when the sales tax was passed, but within the agency, how does this, or have you seen, and can you comment at all, even though it was a ways back, on how that broadened funding source has shaped kind of the agency's connection to the public, recreation, outdoors, conservation, and education type values?
Well, I would think that it's incredibly strengthened that, because we did several things. We constructed the nature centers, expanded education and information. We expanded the land acquisition, so hunting opportunities, fishing opportunities. We built several hundred accesses along the major rivers and floatable streams. And if if you've never heard of anything about Missouri, often folks tell us they've heard about the spring-fed Ozark streams where people can go float a day on a canoe just as a family outing, and canoe liveries and other kinds of businesses down there for tourism and recreation are a really big deal. So just expanding accesses so people can get on the river was a huge step forward, not only for fishing and hunting, but for folks that just want to go out and recreate, and that boating industry. So I could go on with example after example where it certainly allowed staff to reach out and touch folks. In 2000, we began a private lands division where we have 40 private land conservationists that go out and help landowners know what to do for conservation from either the federal farm bill funding or some of the funding that the department makes available. So just that act of providing services to people expanded our connection with the citizens, and then it changed the culture in the department, because now we have people of all different kinds of backgrounds and focus, whether it's outreach and education or private lands or natural history, all working together. So it strengthened that broader scientific and recreational kind of component just of our staff, if that makes sense.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, Kenji?
So, Dave, this is Kenji Sugihara. I had a quick question about the magazine. Has that been critical in terms of getting information out to citizens about what you've been spending the money out? Because as it goes, if money just disappears, everybody's like, what are you doing with it? Has that been a real good tool to message?
Yes. I would answer yes, because it goes out to so many people. Now, in this day and age, there are lots of folks that don't read the magazine or see it, young people, younger professionals, and that's where we've expanded social media, Facebook, YouTube videos, Twitter. We've had a Pinterest account. I don't quite know the number of Pinterest, but I know that the Facebook account's got quite a number of people. We've also used a service called Gov Delivery, which we now have over 100,000 subscribers to, which allows us to send email, or people can sign up for a text message, and we'll send out information about the commission meeting, or buy your permit now, or today's a great day to go out and go mushroom hunting, or other kinds of short messages like that. So both the magazine as well as expanding into how people want to receive information is absolutely critical to making sure people are aware of the department and how that money's spent and what it's buying or what it means to them.
Okay, any other final? Yes, Mike.
David, thanks for the information. You spoke to the fact that there was no advertising, and obviously there were probably discussions back and forth on that. If a state like Oregon were going to look at a similar support for that, what were some of the discussions surrounding advertising? Did you think it would dilute the message? Do you think that people are trying to kind of steer your positions, or it would interject into the conversation the desires of the advertiser, or anything background would be helpful?
Sure, and I might have to, dig up a little more information from our outreach folks on that. I can speak from a little bit of planning or discussions about that. I'm not sure I can answer it 100%, but many of your reasons are exactly the approach, that we wanted to make it just about the department, just about fishing, hunting, outdoor viewing, fish, forest, and wildlife, and we wanted it to be our message and not dilute that with outside interest. Plus, it just gets really crowded. And they described the magazine in 1938 as an experiment. And, of course, they started the experiment and never stopped, since we still continue it. But the branding and the message of what we want to put in without having to clutter that up or spend the extra money for pages from advertising has been one of the primary reasons. But I'll ask and then provide that back to Jim Owens, too, to see if there's any different perspective.
Okay, thanks. Jim.
Dave, when I think about Missouri Department of Conservation, one of the most dramatic things I think about is the nature centers sited in the various urban areas where you connect with urban people. Can you talk just a little bit about your network of nature centers?
Could you repeat the tail end of your statement there? I didn't quite get it.
I think about the nature centers that you've built in the urban areas as a way of connecting to the constituents that supported conservation so strongly, but right. may not have grown up in rural communities and be from the farm. And would you talk a little bit about your nature centers?
So that was one of the items in the design for conservation, a statewide system of interpretive centers. And we have six nature centers. Now, it's interesting. If you go look at that item in that Design for Conservation magazine article, the average annual cost was estimated at $1.8 million. This was in 1974. And now for us we haven't built a nature center in the last 10 years or so, but even then, a single nature center of the type we build was costing, $4 to $8 million just to build the facility and the property and bring it up with, some naturalists and a staff to operate it. So we're probably not going to do a whole lot more of those because the cost is pretty high, but we do have an annual commitment to what we have. They are located primarily in urban centers, Springfield, St. Louis, Kansas City, and here one in the Capitol, the Run Center, which is near the department headquarters. All the fourth graders in Missouri that come and visit the Capitol, and many of them, I wouldn't say all of them do, but many of them do, they often tour the Capitol Nature Center, so at least the child gets an opportunity to visit one of those interpretive centers. Fourth graders get a tree from our tree nursery each year, often distributed through the Nature Center. There's a system of naturalists and programs and other kinds of educational events that families and non-traditional users might be invited to. So the nature centers deliver not only natural history or outdoor kinds of programming, but they'll also have hunter education classes, or they'll have outdoor cooking, Dutch oven cooking classes, or programs just for women that might want to come learn more about the outdoors or how to get started in hunting or fishing. So the centers have become an educational focus, particularly for those urban environments, way beyond just the interpretive center that you might have thought of in the classic field guide or outdoor identification. It's an educational focus, so a very effective tool for connecting with people.
Okay, so I want to be receptive to our time constraints here. If you're willing to cut our break a little bit short, we'll continue the discussion for just a couple more minutes if we're willing to cut the break a little bit short because we want to get to Ian and then we want to make sure we have plenty of time for our breakout session. So, Claire, you had your card up first. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. This is Claire Pucci. David, I've been impressed with the work that your department has been doing for many years since I was at ODFW. And aside from connecting with the public about some of these really exciting things like nature centers and education, land acquisition, things like that, I'm kind of curious because when we reach for the stars, we also have to make sure that these departments, we can continue to do good science to underscore and support all these other wonderful things that we need to do. And I'm just kind of curious how Missouri might have gone about connecting with the public, which sometimes makes the public's eyes glaze over, the monitoring, the surveying, things like that. Do you have tips on how you were successful in making sure that kind of work didn't fall by the wayside and get eclipsed by the sexy stuff?
Right. I think one way has been branching out into social media and the idea of using shorter messages. One thing we also did about 5 years ago was to identify five key messages about the department. An example was Missourians care about conserving forests, fish, and wildlife, or conservation pays by enriching our economy and quality of life. I know someone asked Dave a question about economic impact and whether that was a goal as part of the outcome. We did not include that in the 70s design for conservation, but we certainly do today talk about impacts of tourism, economic enhancement from fish forests and wildlife. We have the dollar figures from the National Survey or some that we commission ourselves to talk about local state sales taxes generated or the impact to the state from, you know, deer hunting or wildlife viewing or other kinds of trout fishing in our trout parks, for example. Just an example where we take that key message, distill it down really short, and then try to deliver it to in a non-traditional way, whether it's through a short video. We've done some what would be called advertising. For example, the National Archery in the Schools program, we made a trailer, 30-second trailer, of a young lady in high school, showed her pulling back the bow, hitting a target, and we played that before the Hunger Games movie. Just an awesome connection of taking a short message, a sport, something she liked to do, something that maybe others would like to do with her, and then go to an audience that might not have ever heard about conservation and packaged in a way that, that might be really attractive and interesting to them. If that gets at your question, and we've tried other things like that, where we just have to shrink the message down and then go to where the people might not have heard of us. We have advertisements at the football stadium in Missouri on their big large screen display where we say that Missouri Department of Conservation, serving nature and you, which is our slogan. Really short, quick message, just trying to establish brand recognition and then hopefully plant the seed that if they saw something in a magazine or social media or on the news, that it would build on that connection.
Okay, Mike and Merrill, quick.
I got a quick question.
Real quick.
This is really more of a nuts and bolts question operationally for your nature centers and interpretive centers. I mean, growing up in Missouri, I went to countless parks and spent lots of time at Bennett Springs, Montauk Springs, places like that. Do the concession fees that you guys are paid by the concessionaires, do those cover some of your operating costs or most of your operating costs? I was just kind of curious how much of your costs are offset by concessions at your facilities.
Well, you know, it's interesting that trout parks are actually operated by the Department of Natural Resources as a park. And our only component is the stocking of the fish. And so none of those fees, you know, that they might collect for the park come to us. They would go to the park operation. Now, we do collect a daily trout tag in those trout parks. There are four trout parks across the state. Again, I'm not sure that I can answer the question if it's self-supporting, but we don't do it as a fundraising activity. I mean, as a revenue activity, we do it to help promote the sport of fishing and the opportunity for folks to come and fish. But that's another question I can ask our fisheries chief and see if it covers our costs. But I'm not sure that it would.
Okay.
Now, on the other hand, we have a tree nursery that delivers about 3 to 4 million seedlings to folks that, whether it's CRP or wildlife food plot planting, and that operation does fund itself. It's not, we don't charge very much for the trees, but it is self-supporting. So it's not offset by the sales tax. Now, it's interesting, and I'm sure, I don't know if Dave would comment on this, but about the other states, when we've done economic surveys where we ask people about willingness to pay or if they'd pay an entry fee to a nature center or to a trout park or anything, the first question they say is, well, don't you have that sales tax? That should pay for it. I don't need to pay a fee. And that's an interesting place to be where folks start to see that alternate funding as the replacement for any kind of fee. And so we've been pretty reluctant. In fact, we've not raised any of our hunting fishing fees for over 10 years because of this great reluctance on the part of the public to to pay an additional price because they know they already pay through a sales tax. So it's I guess what I'm saying, there's a bit of a downside there from practicality. It's just a little awkward to go back and ask for some of those fee increases just because folks expect they've already paid through the alternate funding alternative.
Okay, thanks, Merrill.
I'll check on the okay, draft fees pass. And see how they cover costs.
Okay, Ian, come on up, and we'll get started with you. While he's coming up, Dave, want to thank you for your input. It was extremely valuable. I do have the last question, though, and it's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek. We're pretty sensitive in Oregon about our name. Is it Missouri or Missouri?
Well, it's actually both.
Oh, it is. Okay. Well, I just want to clarify that.
My family said Missouri, but you know, the person in the next office here would say Missouri. So both are correct.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. You've been most helpful to us. We appreciate you taking the time. We just can't thank you enough. Very good input for us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Best of luck in your endeavor. And if we can provide additional information, I'd be glad to visit or provide more.
Okay. And we'll be in touch with you. Thank you.
Okay. Let's move right into the Secretary of State's report. Appreciate it. If you could cut her pretty tight, we'd appreciate it. We're running just a little bit late.
Introduce. And I'm happy to take questions during the course of my presentation. Just let me know.
If you could introduce yourself for the record, and it looks like you have a cohort with you. So,
good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ian Green. I'm a certified government auditing professional and a senior auditor with the Oregon Audits Division. I was one of the lead auditors on these two audits at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today is audit manager Sharon Blasey, who also worked extensively on these two projects. I'd like to begin by providing a brief overview of the role of the Secretary of State's office, and then I will discuss the audit results. Oregon's Secretary of State is empowered by our Constitution to be the auditor of public accounts. 70 professional auditors conduct this role on behalf of the Secretary. We are the only independent auditing organization in Oregon with authority to review programs in all three branches of government. Our office is consistently engaged in audits across multiple agencies and programs. We conduct three basic types of audits: financial, performance, and information technology. The two audits we'll be discussing today are specifically performance audits. Although both audits have significant financial components, their objective was to help improve the efficiency and effectiveness of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Our office selects performance audit topics each year based on observations, risk, public interests, and requests from the legislature. In the case of these two audits, our office decided to look at the agency for two primary reasons. First, a growing public interest relating to natural resource management. And secondly, our last audit at the Department of Fish and Wildlife was over a decade ago. Financial challenges caught our attention early on and became a focus of some of our work. The Financial Condition Review, issued in April 2015, analyzed the financial health of the department. We found that Fish and Wildlife had a recurring cash flow problem that repeatedly put the agency's financial health at risk. Expenses have grown faster than revenues for years. While revenues have been relatively stable, there are mounting pressures, such as the steady decline in hunters and anglers since the 1970s, and an expected decline in federal funding. As you can see in the graph, participation is down both as a percentage of the population and in total sales. These issues are not new. Archival records from 1975 show that Legislative Fiscal reported, quote, "simply stated, the problem of the Wildlife Commission is that the cost of inflation is outstripping the growth rate of revenues." A legislative report from 2000 also noted that Fish and Wildlife's past approach to handling budget shortfalls were often temporary and avoided permanent reductions that would have lowered costs into subsequent biennium. Expenses are likely to remain high, considering years of deferred maintenance, factors contributing to growing workloads, and a multi-million dollar increase to pension expenses over the coming years. Recent estimates suggest pension costs will rise to about 30% of payroll from the 18% they're at now. A very rough estimate for the Department of Fish and Wildlife is that each biennium pension expenses will rise by approximately $3 million. Workload is also growing. With Oregon's increasing population and development, the agency is seeing more workload related to wildlife interactions and permitting activity. There's also increasing workload related to endangered species. For example, the agency reported that 50 employees, three of which were full-time, worked on the potential sage-grouse listing. With expenses outpacing revenues, operating reserves have been routinely depleted. Although shortfalls have been dealt with in part by fee increases, these and other solutions have not been able to address the underlying nature of this problem. We heard numerous concerns that everything has become a priority. The widening gap between responsibilities and resources makes effectively addressing the agency's seven co-equal goals unsustainable. And you can see the listing of the goals on the screen. This led to our second audit report that was issued earlier this year. The objective of that report was to identify management practices that could help reduce the gap between resources and responsibilities that were identified in the financial condition review. In summary, the state of Oregon has two policy options to close the gap: either increase resources or align workloads to existing funding. While there has been some success in increasing support for fish and wildlife activities, these efforts have not generated stable funding. For example, consider the Fish Restoration and Enhancement Program established in 1989. Commercial fishing fees have not been adjusted for inflation to help fund this program. As a result, commercial funding has declined from roughly 30% to 10%. Contributions from the commercial industry have lost significant value. A dollar today buys approximately half of what it did in 1989. The agency is struggling on multiple fronts for funding. For example, wildlife conservation efforts receive little direct public support. We noted various efforts other states have taken to increase funding for their fish and wildlife agencies. This information can be found in Appendix 2 of our report. One of ODFW's challenges is that their broad mission requires them to work cooperatively with other government agencies and private landowners. Very little of the state, approximately 0.3% of state lands, are under ODFW's direct control. I have circled a few of the small areas on the map to the right in blue. You can also see that ODFW needs to work with at least 18 partners, not including cities and counties or private landowners, just for the management of Oregon's coast. We also found some missed opportunities due to insufficient real estate management and unaddressed asset planning and maintenance. Deferred maintenance is a large and growing concern at agency facilities. Many hatcheries have significant infrastructure that is 30, 40, or 50 years old. A report commissioned by ODFW in 2005 found approximately $100 million in maintenance needs. Over the past decade, only about $8 million has been spent on maintenance. Pushing off repairs until replacements are needed is an expensive way to manage these assets. It puts employees at risk, fish and wildlife at risk, and discourages the public from visiting these sites and purchasing licenses. In the past 2 years, the department's management team, led by Director Kurt Melcher, has taken efforts to trim operations and reduce expenses. The agency has reported that these efforts have been successful. Those efforts, though, were not without consequences, as detailed in our report. Generally, we found that ODFW's past efforts tended to be short-term, topic-specific, and reactive. The agency had not determined its mission-critical responsibilities across programs and lacked a comprehensive management strategy. We made the following six recommendations. First, Fish and Wildlife should adopt a long-term comprehensive management strategy. A few elements that should be addressed include setting clear, measurable, and realistic goals, assessing and aligning workloads to available resources and mission-critical responsibilities, and calculating the full cost of service delivery and maintenance. Second, the agency should develop a plan to track and analyze workload efforts. Third, the agency should reassess the maintenance backlog and adopt a strategy for asset planning and maintenance. Fourth, the agency should advocate for pooling grant funds with federal agencies and other partners. Fifth, develop requests for alternative revenue sources. And lastly, agency leadership should work with the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission and the Oregon Legislature to authorize any changes needed to implement these recommendations. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Do you have anything you want to, any, okay, questions? We had this member discussion at the first meeting, and we said we would like to have a kind of a summary, not kind of, a summary report of the what was in the audit, because there was questions about, well, can we get to see the audit? So excellent job. So I have not seen that summary. We're going to make sure we're going to have copies of that for everybody. Appreciate it.
It should be on OLIS.
Okay. Excellent job of summarizing it. Appreciate it. So, yes, sir. Yes, go ahead.
Did you do a six-year forecast of the shortfall in revenues?
We looked at agency forecasts. We didn't conduct any forecast of our own.
And which agency forecast did you see?
The ODFW forecast. I believe they're prepared by Aaron.
Is that the one that was presented to the legislature a few weeks ago?
I'm not sure of that.
Yeah, that's right.
So that forecast showed the shortfall growing from $32 million in the 15-17 biennium to $113 million over that time period. I'm not sure what the assumptions were in making that forecast. Are you familiar with that, and do you agree with it?
I am familiar with the forecast the agency had prepared at the time. I don't know what the specific numbers were. And was that with or without the license fees coming in?
Sure. Yeah, there was, Rob, there was a number of assumptions that were built into that. Those were forecasts that were prepared by the department. The basic underlying assumption in projecting out those budget gaps were that there would be no fee increases, that there would be no improvement in sales. Essentially, our sales would be flat, that there would be increased costs and inflation, both associated with personnel expenses as well as just overall inflation, that there would be no management action by the agency to, essentially, we would fill all positions and pay for them into the future, irrespective of whether we had the revenue to support those positions or not, and that we would fully fund the State Police Fish and Wildlife Enforcement Division at their requested level. So when you build all those assumptions in and you project them out for 2, 4, 6 years, yeah, you get a gap and you get a widening gap.
So that didn't include any attempt to address deferred maintenance over that time period, is that right? Or the PERS increases?
No, at the time we did those budget forecasts, we did not know, you know, what the PERS impacts were going to be, so those were not included. And deferred maintenance was included only insofar as it's in our current budget at a small, you know, there's some attention going to deferred maintenance, but it did not include filling that whole $100 million deferred maintenance.
I'd just like to add that the PERS estimates I provided earlier were just very rough estimates. No official numbers have come out from PERS as far as I'm aware.
Probably going to be worse, but... Kenji?
Yeah, so that's just looking at Oregon in our unique situation, but have there been any efforts into sort of getting a little bit perspective? We talked with folks from Missouri, Montana, and just to find out where in the spectrum we fall in terms of our shortfall, whether these are national trends or not, or just to see if there's any commonality in terms of what we're looking at.
I think in terms of license sales, you're definitely seeing a nationwide trend of declining sales. Changing demographics are largely contributing to that. We looked at some of the practices in a number of other states. I don't have the list off the top of my head, but some of them include Washington, Colorado, Florida, Arkansas, Missouri, and some others as well. And it really varies from state to state what sort of financial condition they're in. I know I looked at a little bit of information from California, and they had recently passed a ballot measure that was allocating more funds to their department. Florida has, I think, a real estate transfer tax that helped to support their efforts. And then you heard about the Missouri efforts. So some states are in a better financial condition than Oregon, but many other states are in the exact same condition that Oregon's in.
Any other questions? Okay, clearly it tells us what the problem. We've got a problem, and we all know that. So we're going to take a break now, but in the interest of time, we're about 20 minutes behind. So maybe, Jim, if it's all right with you, and you can explain what it is, and then when we come back, we'll just go right into our groups, and then you could explain the process, or do you want to do that right now, and then we'll come back? And
how about I do that so okay. that you can come, we don't have to reorganize ourselves when you come back.
Okay.
So we're going to split into two groups, a red group and a green group. The red group is going to meet right here, and I'll be facilitating that with Beth's assistance recording. And in that group, we have Rob Morrison, Rob Ball, Darren Reddish, Jim Martin, Paul Don Eppner, Carrie Westland, and Mike Finley. So you're going to meet here. Second group's going to meet on the other side where Kurt is. Brett will facilitate that, and Alicia will be recording. And that's Scott Welch, Claire Pucci, Keta Gonzalez, Kenji Sugihara, Mike Herbel, Brad Pettinger, Mark Labhart, and Kurt Melcher. And we sent out a problem statement and some questions regarding guidelines. That's what we're going to be working from. And so when we come back, if you could be in those two locations, we'll get things set up.
And we tried to do that just so we could have a kind of a mix of folks. So we'll take about a 30-second break.
No,
take a five-minute break, and then we'll meet in our group. So we'll see you hopefully in 5 minutes.
I have one other announcement. Our conversation is going to be limited to task force members.
I don't think there are enough meetings for this group.
Yeah.
Well, it's a big group.
Yeah.
Half a day here and half a day there. Much listening. Yeah.
Maybe we can talk about that.
Must
a lot of money, yeah.
Okay, I think we're here.
Every month.
Left.
It's all solved.
That's the other thing. Who is going
to talk about that?
Not big.
So I did have one real quick story to tell you. So I had some friends from San Diego who were here a couple weeks ago, when we had just day after day of rain, and one of our guests gets up on the first day, and it's just pouring rain. It also rains on the day after that, and the day after that, and she goes out to lunch and sees one of our neighbor kids, and says out of the blue, "Hey kid, does it ever stop raining around here?" He says, "Well, don't ask me, I'm only 8. So what we wanted to do is have the two groups report back. I'm assuming that this shows us that we have a lot to discuss, and that this is complicated. And but we made some good progress, I'm sure, in both groups. So. Roger was going to report on our group.
Jim.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I'm glad.
Make Roger do it.
Yeah.
There we go. Sure. I'll give you a little capsulization of about four four major take-home points. The first major take-point is the challenge with ODFW is to understand they have two simultaneous jobs, both of which are under extreme squeeze pressure right now. One job is maintain the science used by everybody who impacts the ecosystem to understand whether we're managing fish and wildlife in a sustainable manner or not. This constant budget pressure has been under eroding the ability of ODFW to maintain that science basis that everybody else is depending on. Whether you're a watershed council or an NGO, there's only one entity that's out there counting the noses and really is going to say these wildlife fish species are in decline or these ones are sustainable. That's core job one. If we don't maintain the science and do it in a quality way going forward, everybody else's ability to understand their impacts on the ecosystem is in severe trouble. The second job is provide for outdoor recreation, which is a gigantic economic engine in Oregon, and it includes consumptive harvest, fishing, and hunting, which hopefully are sustainable because we've been assured by job one that they are, and also expands to outdoor recreation of many types on our wildlife management areas and other lands as well. So they're constantly balancing these two core jobs, being the fundamental core science and then a purveyor of outdoor recreation, which is a major economic engine. Both of those jobs are under extreme stress right now because the current funding model is not working and won't work adequately into the future unless we make a core change. So the second thing we wanted to talk about was three core levels of objective that we might settle on. And one core level objective is what I would call the minimalist approach, which is how do we take the current service level of the department and just keep it whole and project it forward, which would be no small deal. The legislature struggled real hard on that, and clearly we've got fractured situation within the department, and clearly we've got a forward projection which shows a gigantic shortfall. So just doing job one, the minimalist job, would be a hell of a challenge. Job two is add all the deferred maintenance on and the PERS challenges and the other personnel challenges which are going to come on. How do we maintain the current service level of the department and deal with deferred maintenance, which we haven't dealt with, legislature has been unable to deal with, given the fees that would have to go up on hunting and fishing and given the difficulty of accessing more general fund. The third job would be to create the Missouri-style conservation design, to go to the full boat and say, look, this is the dream. This is the third level that would help us accomplish the dream and reestablish ODFW as the premier conservation organization in the state. So we need to think about how big of a financial challenge it would be to do just job one. What about adding job two, all the deferred maintenance and PERS costs and the other things that we can reasonably anticipate that start to deal with that gap that Kurt laid out for us. And the third one is what would it take to do a true conservation design to really get ready for the future of Oregon and to do the job that we hope we're going to do for everybody else, which is to really have them understand whether the natural world of Oregon is sustainable or not, and to be able to spot big challenges before they happen, and we just are counting the noses as the stocks are moving toward extinction. So that's the way we were kind of thinking about the challenge that this task force has. Are we going to try to do job one, job two, or job three? Part of that challenge is also understanding what level of support would it take to get all the way to job three. The thinking in our group was job one and job two is not enough. We really need to get to a full conservation design, understanding that's a lot more money, understanding it's a lot more political resistance in a zero-sum game, especially if you're trying to access general fund or lottery fund or some really big chunk of fund. Now, the third thing we talked about was criteria. We have a set of criteria we'd like to suggest for the group that any idea that we come up with, we use as a lens for whether this idea ought to continue to be analyzed and pursued, whether this idea is a non-starter. And here's the criteria we suggest. Raise enough money to actually solve the problem, whether you're trying to get one, two, or three levels of problem solved. Two, a mechanism that's expected to grow over time, so we won't just be right back in the same problem 10 years from now, because it created a limited amount of money and the need outgrew it because of inflation and other things. Three, it has to be supported by a broad base of financial support. Much better to get a small fraction of a big fund than to try to tax the heck out of some small sub-population of our economy and deal with all the political resistance that will come from that. And in order to access a broad base of financial support, we're going to have a broad base of public support. So it's very clear that whatever we try to accomplish is going to have to be some kind of a public campaign that explains the critical job that ODFW and what's going to happen to Oregon if we don't do that job well. Now, there are some people, like a lot of us sitting around this room, are intimately aware of ODFW's role and history and know all about it. But the vast majority of people in Oregon think ODFW is funded by taxes now. The vast majority of people in Oregon do not even understand that ODFW is primarily funded by federal fund and hunters and anglers fees. So we've got a tremendous communication job to mount a campaign that even brings people up to date with, is there a problem, what's the problem, and what would a solution look like? So we have to have a broad base of public support if we're ever going to create a broad base of financial support. We want a criteria in there that says we're honoring the sportsman's contributions, so we're not leaving the sportsman behind, and that it's politically doable, which means you're able to overcome the natural resistance to a new funding model. And as I mentioned, better to have a small fraction peeled off of a big fund than a big fraction peeled off of a small fund. So those are the criteria that we suggest we ought to consider as a lens for evaluating any of our ideas. And then finally, we think this whole issue of brand development is crucial. As we listen to the success stories coming from the other states, they're all talking about their communication strategy, and they're all talking about expanding the sense of what the quality of the brand stands for. We think we have people on this task force who have a business background, and we can also learn from the successful initiatives which have happened around the country in terms of how they communicated and how they branded. And we could get started with a subcommittee of our task force just working on what we know about the quality of the brand, what is the level of public support for ODFW now, what will it need to be down the road to solve this problem and overcome political resistance. So we like the idea of having particularly some of the business representatives in this group lend their expertise to the branding challenge, and then also learning from the branding challenge of the other successful initiatives that were highlighted to us, reaching back out to Missouri, Arkansas, Iowa, Minnesota, and saying, what did you learn about branding? How did you go about doing it? What changed as a result? The core issue for us is we shouldn't aim short, we should aim long, and we should create a significant enough campaign that we actually achieve a solution to this problem, rather than just getting worn down as what usually happens. So that was it. Anything I missed, group, in the red group?
I might note we actually did deal with the problem statement. And obviously we went much beyond it. And the group favored, actually the first full paragraph on page two with some modifications versus the straw man that staff we brought forward. So we do have a problem statement going with all of this as well. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah. So for our group, we ran out of time. We got a lot done, and because we ran out of time, there's probably, I just said, I'll report out what we've done here. There's probably somebody, a very, very talented group, so there's probably somebody who's better apt to report this out, but I'll take my shot. So we retweeted the problem statement. We did it. I don't know if this is where the other group was, but there was some questioning about, do we frame a problem statement as, you know, the problem we're trying to solve, or do we flip it and frame it as an opportunity statement, which, when I read the second paragraph on page two, I guess we plan to do, that's what you all were thinking about too. But we, without getting into it, we edited and tweaked the problem statement. We actually made it more concise, So, and you know, we've tweaked it in ways that recognize that there's a, it's not just about the current problem, there's about the, there's the future. And Oregon will continue to change in its demographics and also in its ecology. So building in notions of future ecological landscape and engaging Oregonians not just in recreation and education, but actually in conservation itself. So we'll get the edits on the problem statement. Hopefully, with the other group, everything meshes, and we're all goals. We talked about each members of the task force have to own what it is we're talking about as the vision and what we're solving for. And so we spend a good bit of time on the problem statement. Then we start to get to the questions on page 4 of the handout, or 3, I guess. So what would we want? What would we want a new business model or funding model to accomplish? What would the criteria be that we would apply to a new source of funds? And what did we learn from the presentations we heard? And that, those three bullets or questions all involve conversation and answers blended together. And so some of the criteria we discussed are. We wanted something that would be significant enough to leverage future opportunities. We, I think, like the other group, were thinking big. I think that everybody is not just looking at how do we dial in money to solve the existing gap around current programs. It's we're thinking bigger. Adaptable and accountable. So the same notion as the other group had around, we need to make this adaptable enough to recognize that the world will continue to change. We need a funding source that can adapt with it. Accountable, and using accountability as a way to tell the story, and tell the story through budgets and accountability around money that is a broader story around values. So politically viable, and politically insulated. Those were two criteria. One is, you know, a lens around what's going to give us a realistic chance of success in moving something through voters, either voters in this building or voters at a ballot box. And politically insulated, meaning that it's the brand concept, it's what's popular enough that either we can legally insulate it or it's so popular that nobody's going to want to rate it for some other purpose. Clear benefit between the nexus of the funds and the nexus of the you know, what people are paying for and the source of the funds itself. A couple last ones here, and this is important. So something that actually increases access to opportunity and increases recreational opportunities themselves. So I think Kurt made the point that look, if the department is only about hunting and fishing opportunities, we can probably solve that issue by you know working with the current model. The opportunities that we're talking about are broader than hunting and fishing, and I think the full group recognize that, that they are, then that's the big lift. That's where we need to look beyond. And so where we're talking about criteria, the group, our group landed with, we do want to increase access to opportunities and recreational opportunities, and that relates to tearing down some barriers. And I think Brad, you probably said it best.
First time.
Whether we call him non-consumptive or non-extractive or whatever the label is, that those users are both stakeholders and beneficiaries around what Oregon does around fish and wildlife and habitat. So it's a responsibility to be a stakeholder and a benefit and recognize that you're a beneficiary as well. So it gets at that nexus of funding that's where we landed. We can probably summarize the criteria in the documents that we turn out from here in a more concise way. But did I miss anything?
I have a question for you. That last point you made is similar. I'm thinking I'm hearing with my ears a similar comment to what we were saying in broad financial support is going to have to flow from broad public support. And when you're talking about the beneficiaries and the constituencies, you're talking about exactly the same point. So we won't break out of this funding model until the public views ODFW as significantly meaningful to their reality and they support it. From that would flow the broader public funding support.
Yeah, no, I think we had probably one point when we were listening to your report out. We were wondering if you were eavesdropping on us. Most are going to pay taxes. We expect anything based on those tax dollars. Not the case. So there's an education of the public around why is this agency valuable. And then we left our conversation with, some question marks. How broad are we going to go with the solution? Because there are other agencies, and multiple people in our group said, you know, this connection to public health is really ripe. We need to pursue this.
EQ, so, no gaming, all the natural resources.
One other thing I might add is we briefly just at least brought up some of the same points you did, Jim, about we've got to have a scientific basis to make sure that we are accomplishing the mission of the agency, which is to prevent the serious decline of indigenous species, et cetera, and also provide recreational benefits and opportunities. So I think that underscored a lot of the discussion that we had, too. So we didn't overlook that at all.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate everybody's great input into that process. I'm going to go for public comment, and then I'll close the meeting. So public comment, I think we had at least one. Come on up, sir. We have a couple. So.
I just wanted to speak really briefly, mainly.
If you could introduce yourself, please.
Sure. My name is Adam Meyer. I'm with the Oregon Conservation Network, but this is mostly just on behalf of myself. So I think I'm probably, other than all the ladies here, the only person under 30 in the whole room. So I just wanted to make sure that the voice of sort of the younger generation, the millennial generation, isn't forgotten, because we're coming up on being the largest voting bloc. We're typically the people who are out there on the weekends hiking around, doing a lot of these things, and oftentimes not doing as much hunting and fishing and the traditional style of outings that happens. And so there's a number of things that I think go along with more young people getting involved that I think are just important to remember. When we're talking about the pamphlets early on that some of the other states are doing, we don't read pamphlets anymore. Investing in those sorts of technologies to get the word out, I think is not gonna be helpful moving into the future here. But at the same time, education is incredibly helpful. If you grow up with a parent who teaches you to hunt and fish, you're more likely to hunt and fish. I know a lot of people who live in the city who have never hunted, never fished. They would love to learn how to do that, but they don't know where to go to do that and where to learn. If there is some way that they could actually get that education and actually engage with that community somehow, that would be something I think a lot of people would like to do. So there are things that we don't have access to that might not be just a generational thing that we don't hunt and fish more because we choose to, we just don't know how to. So just things to think about. I think there's a lot of new demands that we have. Referring to the hunting and fishing, we tend to like to go out and walk our dogs and raft and mountain bike and do those sorts of things. And we do it very close to where we live. There are a small population of people, myself included, who go out on multi-day trips and do a lot of big adventures, but most people go out for a day and go out and do something quick. And so the nature of how we interact with the world, the natural world, and how we pay for things is much quicker. I'm less likely to buy a season pass for something, and I'm much more likely to pay $10 for something on my phone for a quick day to do something. If I could pay on a cell phone for, you know, a quick pass when I'm hiking a trail, I'm much more likely to do that than go out and make a big investment of $60, $70, $80 for some sort of seasonal thing. People spend money on their cell phones, you know, 10 times a day, very quickly without thinking much about it. But if you tell me I have to pay $100 for something, I'm not going to do it. So just how people pay for things, the technology can make a big difference, and sort of the quantity in which you buy it can make a big difference. And then just, you know, engaging kids early, engaging kids through education with things like outdoor school is huge. But also engaging them in more traditional methods would be awesome. You know, if you have free things for kids, then their parents follow them, and they join and they do those things too. So pulling in young people in that sense. And then one last point about sort of the deferred maintenance and deferred costs. I think it's really important. We're talking about $100 million in deferred maintenance. I think it's really important to remember who's deferred that maintenance and who's paying for those things. And the generation that is starting to retire has let things fall apart largely. PERS is gonna be a huge thing on our book. The transportation infrastructure around our country and in the state, the energy infrastructure, our schools are some of the worst in the country right now. There's a lot of deferred maintenance all around the state, and that's not your guys' job to figure out right here. But keep that in mind when you're thinking about putting more costs on the next generation of people, and think about spreading that out economically over diverse communities and disenfranchised communities. So, thanks.
Well said.
Good, yeah, thank
good
you.
Good points.
Good job. Thanks.
That was the kind of fresh thinking I hope we would hear today. What he just brought
could
out.
Could you
was,
just introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm Alan Barker. Yep. I live in Kaiser. You know, one of the things that was brought out was that stakeholders are also the beneficiaries. They're not. It's like right now we're talking about he just mentioned the people like in Portland, the big cities. They're not out hunting and fishing. They're not. They're not the beneficiaries right now. Great point that he made. They need to be educated. That can bring on new customers. Brings on new permits. We're only providing 13% of fishing licenses to the population, and 6% are buying hunting licenses. Stakeholders are not the beneficiaries. That's who you got to hit. Or grow your customer base, like what he's talking about. How many meetings are you guys going to be doing in the evenings? If you don't do them in the evenings, you're missing the customer base. The working guy's out there one buying the permits. He's the one out there buying a hunting license. If you don't include their fresh ideas and stuff, you're going to miss out on a whole lot of ideas, and you're going to alienate them again. Adaptability, accountability, that's all part of it. They have to be heard. Politically viable. You know, Columbia's ad agency, get a hold of Scott Welch and their ad agency. When you guys come up with a campaign, they've always had fun and humorous ads. I mean, that's what we need.
So which one of us is going to be buried in ice? So.
But you get the idea. They're funny. They're humorous. Yeah. They're not just like a public announcement or something that's put out over the airways that's boring, and you hear 14 times a day because the feds are funding it. Do something that's creative. Scott, we're looking at you, dude.
You know, Gert did do an ad for the Forest Service last year during the height of the forest fires, reminding people that she would come out for the fire, so she might be interested in some more stuff.
There you go. So, you know, good ideas there. There was a lot of talk about conservation. Be very careful that ecology programs and conservation programs don't choke off your access and the use of what you're trying to do. When I hear conservation, I hear ecology stuff going on, I think, crap, there goes that fishery. We're not going to be able to get access to it. Mr. Morton, can I ask you how much the federal government contributes to Oregon's fish and wildlife?
Well, it's about half of the department's budget, as I understand it.
Okay, 1 to 2% of our entire of the state's budget goes to fish and wildlife right now.
We got remember 3 minutes, so if we wrap up, please.
If I'm wrong, commercial land taxes.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Is about $800 million. Okay, I'm going someplace with this on a trade.
Okay.
Okay. You'd take it education. Education, right now, everybody thinks education sucks. You look at where we are with our rating in the United States and what's going on with education right here, and demography is changing, but we're not changing the budget. Go after the reps and the senators and say, look, we want to do some changing here. We want to take some of the property taxes from commercial business and allow them to contribute to fish and game for a shortfall. Because your infrastructure problems with the fisheries and stuff, that's a shortfall. You fix it, it's good for 20 years, maybe 30 years. It's not a long-term thing. You can fix it with special effects, special contributions, or trading budget stuff for a quick fix now, and it's good for 20 or 30 years. And the rest of your infrastructure of your labor expenses and things like that, that can be planned for long-term.
Okay. Great. Okay? Thank you. Appreciate your comments. Anybody else want to weigh in? Okay, just want to summarize. We had four objectives today. We met three of those. One of the objectives for this meeting was to gain a further understanding on what some other states have done. We did that. We wanted to gain an understanding of what was in the audit. We did that. And we wanted to begin the process of developing our priorities, principles, and begin the process of developing criteria. We did that. What we didn't achieve today was we were trying to hope that we would reach agreement today on the problem statement, and we'll work that for the next meeting. So we met three of the four objectives that we're going to have. So meeting three, it's my hope that we will reach consensus on the problem statement. We will finish hopefully working on the criteria, and I'm going from some of our notes from previously. We will begin discussing options, and we will hear from hopefully from Kurt about the Blue Ribbon panel and some of the results from that. I want to tell you, I want to at least apologize to you. We were optimistic, Jim and I, that we could cram all this into, and clearly we ran out of time and we pushed you a little bit. And so we probably had too much on the agenda for today, and so we had to kind of rush through some things. So we'll learn from that, and we'll try to watch our time for next time and maybe reduce the amount of optimism that we can get all this done in this period of time. So we'll continue to work on that. One of the issues I think we got to address is the amount of time that we're having for our meetings. We are trying to cram too much in. Either we might want to talk about as a group about extending our meeting times or moving it to a different time or reducing the amount of stuff that we have, but we've got to be done by August. So we may want to discuss as a group, do we want to have more meetings in order to devote the time needed to do this? Yes, Jim.
I just give you a little bit of feedback. Once we're invested in coming all down here, I would rather start at 10 in the morning and work through lunch then cram a bunch more meetings in. So
okay.
So far we've only got a kind of just an afternoon mode, but if we need better quality of our work, let's just extend the day out rather than adding a whole bunch of other meetings which require new
good
travel
advice.
Costs.
Yeah, and maybe even extend it even into the evening to allow these folks that maybe even go into some evenings too. So that come ready for the meeting three to discuss that. We'll discuss it as a task force too, as for Jim and I to see too. So, Jim, anything?
And 50 years. We can have pizza, but I can't have beer.
You can?
I can. I thought those were very informative presentations by the two Daves, and we'll draft a thank you letter to them to have Mark sign. And thank you for your hard work today. Yes, we compressed a lot. I think now as staff we have a digestion and translation exercise. So we'll take
factors, what including
came from the two groups, and we'll meld that into a white paper. We'll get that to you here fairly quick. And we're going to want to know whether we captured things correctly and fully. So we'll certainly take advantage of the time between now and the next meeting with some assignments to you. Encourage you to continue the research of all
I know what the one kid
the other states that we sent out. And we're going to explore some work group concepts as a tool to get work done in between meetings. So thank you. And the last thing I'll say is, it only rains twice a year in Oregon, October through April and May through June.
We're adjourned. We're adjourned.